Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello once again, friends, and welcome to the Fergan podcast. I'm your host, Dan, and for this episode, we're going to get quite technical, really, and it's going to be an unapologetically heathen episode of the Fergan podcast, because we're joined by Mark Perrier of the Norwenna Society. We're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the lore, because that's what Mark is best known for and most knowledgeable on. So I think we've got a lot of very important, very interesting talking points to get through in this episode, which Mark and I put together over the last few weeks of preparing for this. So, just to kind of bring Mark in, the Norwenna Society, I mean, Mark can probably talk a bit more on this, but the modern incarnation of the Norwenna Society is a kind of reincarnation of an original Norwenna Society. But I'll let Mark talk a little bit about that. So, Mark, it's great to be speaking with you. And how are you doing?
Hey, it's great. Great to be on here. Great to be here with you and all of your listeners. It's just, I love doing these podcasts because we love to teach people what we're doing.
So if you could just talk a little bit about your background coming to heathenry and forming or rather kind of reigniting the Norwenna Society and your reasons for doing so.
Absolutely. So I originally became a heathen back in the late 80s, right? I've been around for a long time, getting old, right? And the thing was for me is that I started reading books on it a lot. Back then, there wasn't a lot of information available. There wasn't the internet and all that stuff. And so we had to basically just get what we could. And so I basically, as a heathen, gone through several incarnations because you go through like this new age phase. And you think like all these weird new age books are like, that's what it is and all that stuff. And then you start to meet good people who are, you know, solid and they teach you that that's not the case and that there are better ways to look at it. And then there was an even further incarnation when we started the Norwenna Society and the work we started doing because we started learning how to reconstruct the religion, right? And that was really it. It was because like we started, you know, when I was first getting into it, we started collecting, you know, magazines and getting connected to all these different groups and organizations and learning about their literature and just trying to figure out what it was, you know, what is this and how does it work? I remember when I first met a guy, I was living in Mississippi, right? At the time I was just a kid and the guy told me, yeah, I worship these gods. And I was just fascinated by it. I was like, I don't understand what this is. I've never heard of it before. And I don't know what you're talking about. And so I immediately went to the library, started reading on it. And I was like, this is incredible. You know, like, this is like the faith of our ancestors. This is where we come from, you know? And so it just, you know, over years, I started reading more. And it was probably like in the mid 90s, I came across the work of Dr. Victor Rydberg, right? And when I've been getting all the publications and the magazines, I always paid attention to the letters to editor, because those letters were like the internet, you know, for us then. It was like a way for heathens to talk about the community and what was going on and, you know, what was happening here and there and all that stuff. And I really wanted to read that more than anything to see what everybody was doing. And so as I would read those, one of the things that kind of stood out to me the most was people talking about how much we lost, how the Christian conversions had destroyed our faith and everything was fragmented and there wasn't really anything there. And so we just kind of had to put things together the best that we could. Well, when I later came across the works of Victor Rydberg, I, you know, read the book thoroughly the first time through. And I was just amazed. I was like, this is the blueprint. This is what we need right here. This is the very thing that we need in order to rebuild this religion. And that sort of, you know, began a series of research. Back then at that time, there were a lot of books that were out that were everybody was writing just sort of like primers. They were trying to like cram the religion all into one book. And I started to try to do that. I was like, well, I'm going to try to write a primer, but I'm going to try to like add as much detail to it as I possibly could. And when I did, the book just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it just, it became something like nobody was ever going to read. It was just a massive tome that I was like, this is ridiculous. Nobody's going to want to read this. And so I remember I was watching a video that a buddy of mine had showed me, and it was on a Hindu festival. And we were sitting there watching it, and it was just like this lightning strike, eureka moment that sort of changed my whole life when I'm sitting there watching this festival, because everything that they were doing was all their entire culture was on display at once. Like it was just this organized chaos where you'd see people dancing. Some people are making food. Other people are chanting to the gods. Other people are, you know, wearing costumes and playing music. And all of these different things are taking place all at once. And I realized right then that you can see the culture, but you have to disseminate it. You have to look at it from one aspect to another. And then once you do that, you focus on those aspects, you know, then you can start to learn more. So I had this, you know, lightning strike. The guy thought I was crazy. I ran out of the room. I was like, I gotta go. Took off. And it just started writing like crazy. And I came up with what we call the 12 Fundamentals Project. And this is basically just breaking down, you know, lore, law, diet, dance, music, folk and ancestry, you know, ritual and prayer, all of these different aspects of the culture. And then once we started focusing on them, we started making discoveries, you know. And, you know, these discoveries just sort of come to us. I mean, there's so much information out there on it. And all these people have been telling us all these years that that it's not there, or it's all Christianized, or it's this, that, and the other. Like, it's just not true. I mean, at this point, we have like completely disproven that and shown people that this is there. And we show a lineage to it. We're not just saying, you know, just look at these Christianized sagas or whatever, like compare them from one place to another. Look at the Romans like Tacitus and the Muslims like Ibn Fadlan and all that stuff, and see how these practices form a consistent line. You know, you see Viking ship burials and stuff like that in Ibn Fadlan. You see that in the sagas. You see, you know, processions that are in Tacitus. You see that in the sagas. You see things in the Eddas. You see all this stuff in the lore that forms a consistent line of research. And if you have a methodology where you're actually trying to prove the religion, then everything becomes different. You change the whole paradigm. And so we formed the Norna Society. It was like around 2008, I think. Maybe 2006, I don't remember. We wrote the book, The Nature of Ossetru, and that was like my first attempt at really trying to grasp this and show people like just a basic idea behind it. It was a primer book, but it was, you know, just trying to show some of the research that we're doing. That research has greatly evolved since we started that and wrote that book. The Norden Society has grown and grown and grown and just gotten bigger. I mean, we've just, you know, more and more people follow us, more and more people are liking our work. And we eventually, you know, took Rydberg's works and developed what we call the Epic Method, right? And from the development of the Epic Method, we, you know, wrote the Ossetru Edda and the Odinist Edda. Well, not wrote them, we put them together, you know. Rydberg's thing was that he built this concept of a chronological order of mythic time, right? And that if you look at Völuspá, you see that this mythic time, this chronological order exists within that poem and then is part of like an overall scheme of the entire lore. And so he believed very strongly that based on this and other key points of evidence that he presents in his books, that you can see that our ancestors had what they called the epic chain, or what he calls that, the epic chain. And this chain of events was something that where like stories would evolve, stories would be inspired or revealed to people, whoever, you know, how religious you want to look at it. And if they were popular enough or they became part of something religious and devotional, they would be added to the chain. And then the ones that weren't, they were just like localized tales. Those later became like fairy tales and stuff like that. So this epic chain is sacred to us. So when we wrote the Ossetru Edda, a lot of people thought we were trying to write a Bible. You know, they got really confused by that and all that stuff. Now, we do teach people that orthopraxy and orthodoxy, that those are real things. Polytheist religions have those. You know, it's not something like people who are anti-Christian reactionaries freak out over stuff like that. But it's like, you know, these are things that you have to prove. You have to make arguments, not just, you know, use emotion to make a plea, right? So if something comes out in the research, we just follow the research and wherever it leads us. right?
Yeah.
But we weren't necessarily trying to create a Bible, you know. What we were trying to show people is that it's not the text itself that's sacred, it's the epic that's sacred, right? That's what was sacred to our ancestors. And they had storytellers all over Northern Europe that would have been telling these stories and presenting them and showing them for audiences. And that's how we get the Poetic Edda, because the Poetic Edda and the Skaldic poetry and stuff like that is written kind of in a coded language. So because people would, you know, reason these out as like puzzles, you know, that's how you see, like, in when Snorri Sturluson is describing in Skaldskaparmal, the poetry and the kinnings and all that stuff, it's like puzzles that people have to figure out. So the Poetic Edda and the Skaldic poetry gives us snippets of the epic, even though that we don't have the epic itself, you know, we have pieces of it. It's the idea that we have this, you know, that we see it in the Poetic Edda. And because of that, the Poetic Edda is our most important source. And the reason why anybody who's kept up with our work and our research over the years are going to see that we have controversial theories that people don't, they're just surprised by. They're like, I don't understand. You know, you guys say hell is earth. You talk about the, you know, that there is no nine worlds, that there's nine homes. There's only three worlds of the tree. And all this, all these different aspects that we teach are different. The reason why our work is different is because all of the other academic schools of thought that have ever developed, we've proven their biases. We have a video series called The Academic Schools of Thought. We've shown how every one of them are really actually trying to disprove our religion, where we're trying to prove it. And we always say that the Poetic Edda is the highest source, whereas they almost uniformly have always said that Snorri Sturluson is the highest source, even though Snorri Sturluson cites the Poetic Edda. So that's really how our methodology developed. We see a hierarchy of sources, starting with the Poetic Edda. We don't discredit or discount a Snorri. We critique him and point out where he's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And then we use what he, like the, his stories on Thor, like the adventures of Thor are great. I mean, and they're proven, and there's lots of stuff in the Prose Edda that we can use, but there's stuff in there that we have to show is incorrect. And it goes against what's in the Poetic Edda. And when it contradicts the Poetic Edda, we cannot allow it to do so, you know,
right?
Because there it is. That's the heathen source.
You know? Yeah, no, I agree. So, and I mean, you've pretty much just given us like an overview of the conversation that we're going to have today. So anyone who's just listened to Mark, I mean, Mark, anyone who's familiar with Mark's work knows that he is a fountain of knowledge. And I think he's demonstrating that right now with, you know, his ability to speak with, well, authority, or certainly a very strong view on various areas of heathenry. And for those of you who are kind of a bit feeling a bit lost after listening to Mark speak just now, we're going to go through some of these ideas in a bit more detail, kind of one at a time. But it's a real, I mean, it's a real honor to speak with someone like Mark who's been involved with heathenry, as I like to call it. You know, I know others, maybe Mark himself prefers Arsatru, but heathenry since, you know, the 80s, because in the post-internet age, it's easier for someone to come across these ideas, to learn about the faith, to know which books to pick up, to be able to just to buy them, you know, on Amazon or wherever people prefer to use. I imagine back in the 80s, it was a lot of it was word of mouth. A lot of it was just kind of hearing whisperings and murmurings from people recommending a certain book and kind of finding your way. And it's really interesting to me that one of your first ports of call was Viktor Rydberg. And it seems to me that that kind of set the tone of your path forward and the Norrøna Society. So, I mean, what was that with regards to Viktor Rydberg? I've not actually read any of his books. I have to confess, it's a name that I've heard talked about over the years. I know people who think very highly of his work, and I know that it is an important work. Which was the book of his that you read first, and what books do you recommend of his?
Well, if you want to get into the research, right? It's the one who translated the book was Rasmus Andersen into Teutonic mythology or Germanic mythology. The book in Swedish is Undersökningar I Germanisk mytologi, which means Investigations into Germanic Mythology, Volume 1 and 2.
Right, thank you.
Now, where it gets confusing, right? And the best way to do this is just go on germanicmythology.com. That's William Reeves' website. He's the best researcher on Victor Rydberg. He's the best researcher, period.
William Reeves
is my buddy, and he is a beast as far as this stuff goes. And the researches into Germanic mythology sort of lays out the groundwork. And Rydberg had a lot of different incarnations of his own sort of versions of the epic, because he was really just trying to reach the youth with it. You know, so he was telling, he wrote the book kind of like in a fairy tale kind of sense. He had Our Father's God Saga, which William translated. William translated the second volume of the Investigations, and Rosmus Anderson translated the first volume. Now, this is where it gets confusing, because Rosmus Anderson translated the first volume in three volumes. And so for the longest time, like literally, William and I had the hardest time trying to convince people that there was a second volume, because they kept saying, yeah, it's Rosmus Anderson. He has three volumes. And I was like, no, Rydberg had two volumes, and Rosmus Anderson only translated the first volume in three volumes, which is like takes you all over
the And is the second volume of Rydberg's translated?
Yeah. William has that on his site.
Yeah, but not by Rasmussen.
No, this is by William Reeves.
William Reeves
actually translated both of them, you know, and he's got the translations on his website, and you can go on there. I mean, his website is a fountain of knowledge. Like, if you want to go on there and find like everything, then it's on William Reeves' website. And that's the thing about the internet age, is that the internet age has allowed us to have so much material and so many things that we can put together. Right. And the thing is, for heathens, and this is something that I implore people to do. A lot of people think that, you know, the people in the Norn society are, you know, that we could be kind of rough around the edges, you know, because we try to convince people that this is the next step forward for our faith. Right. And we're not trying to disparage people. We're not trying to tell people that you're bad or that you're wrong or that you've been doing things incorrectly or anything like that. Okay. And sometimes things have gotten heated in the past. But the thing about it is that we're trying to show people that in order for us to evolve, we have to accept that we are still in the Reconstruction era. We're not out of that yet, right? And so we have to appreciate and value the idea that we can move forward as discoveries are made. And there's going to be a point where we can get where we're like, okay, this is it. This is the tradition. This is what we're doing. You know, and we're getting there. You know, every day we're doing more and more research. We're about to put out our next book, which is called The Ivanrunner. It's book two of that series. And we're going to be breaking down all the ritual stuff. And I know you want to go into that later, so I'll just focus on what I'm talking about. But the thing is that, you know, Rydberg opened these doors for us because Rydberg was a religious scholar. Okay. And this is so important for everybody to understand, because for the longest time we were kind of butting heads and showing people and telling people to stop listening to these academics. And everybody thought that we were like anti-academic, and it's like, no, like we're as pro-academic as you can get, you know. But the thing is that what we had to do is sort of delineate and break down why we question the academics, right? And why we question the universities. And so that's why we created the Mythological Schools of Thought. This was a series of videos we did. We're going to eventually do one on our school, the Epic School. We want to make that one a really big production and stuff. But basically what it is you have to look at these five schools of thought that exist, that have existed in mythological studies for the longest time. And these schools have been prominent in universities. They have represented the studies into this religion for centuries now, right? All the way into the Roman times. Because the Romans and the Greeks were the first ones to really start mythological study, right? They studied those in their universities and their philosophers and their schools started studying this world religions mainly as a method to assimilate people into their empire, right? And this is how the Interpretatio school developed, the Graeca Interpretatio Graeca and the Interpretatio Romana, right? And these Interpretatio schools would basically just go into a country and they would find similarities to their gods and say, see, you just got different names for the same gods, right? So love our empire, right? And so they started studying all this stuff. And I think it was Herodotus, the first one that came out, you know, breaking that down and showing these similarities between them and the Egyptian gods or the Syrian gods, as I believe it's Syrian gods for them. And he made these comparisons, and then it just sort of became a thing, right? Now, after this, the Euhemerist school started, right? And this was by the philosopher Euhemerus. Euhemerus was an atheist who just saw these gods and these religions as just ancient kings and queens. And because there were kings who, you know, elevated themselves to the position of God. And so it sort of just made sense to him that all the gods were at one point kings and queens who just had people believe in them and worship them, right? I think the word is apotheosis. And the concept of that is the basis for all religion. That's what Euhemerists believe. Now, that's not true, and that's been disproven, but it is something that proliferated and then was taken by the Christians and made into their primary argument against paganism, right? Now, like I said, none of this stuff was true or real, and people who believe in it today are literally falling for like Christian propaganda. This is stuff like we in the video, we break down, like show how Lactantius was one of the main proponents of it. He was the guy who was the mentor of Constantine's son. And, you know, they were the ones who made Rome Christian, and they spread Christianity using these apologetic methods and all of these different things that they were putting into the empire helped the Roman Empire to become Christian. Now, this spread throughout the empire and spread through different countries, and it came into Germania through the Franks, right? The history of the Franks is the first time we see Jordanes talks about the, what we call the Germanic Euhemerism, right? Or Teutonic Euhemerism. And basically what this did is just like other cultures were doing is as they were Christianizing, they were trying more and more to link themselves to Rome, right? And so they created the story of that the original Germanic people were the Osimen, who were people who came from Asia, right? And they just created a fake etymology and said the Asia men were the same as the Osimen, who were the Iser, right? And that's the gods. And so Odin was Priam, and you know Thor was like Ajax, or I can't remember what characters or what, but their Euhemerist story basically plays out as the Trojan War and connects to the founding of Rome, right? And so all these gods were just originally Roman characters, and that became like this storyline that gets passed on and on and on through all these sources, and we break down all the sources they go through all the way to the Prose Edda.
Yeah, right? So if I can just interject there. And this is something that I've never really thought of before, but when you are trying to convert, a pagan Europe, to be able to tell the people that their gods that they believe in weren't actually gods, they were just kings. It's a way of allowing or creating a circumstance where those people can accept the Abrahamic God, whilst right. still kind of being flattered. It's almost kind of like, your gods, they're great, but they were just great men, you know, so they're, right. they're kind of flattering the folk with in one sense, but in the other, they're leaving room for the monotheistic Abrahamic God to come in. So it seems to me that it was a very kind of pragmatic, very deceptive method of overcoming pagan Europe. And as you rightly say, too many modern pagans still fall for that. You still hear too many modern pagans saying the gods were our ancestors. We are descended from the gods, right?
Right. I mean, and in a sense, I mean, the gods are our creators, you know, you yeah. can say that. And then there's Rig who blessed the three families in that sense, but not in the sense that they're like what you're saying, you know, because I think, and you're exactly right. Like that's exactly what happened because, you know, as you probably know, we have the Anglo-Saxon genealogies that King Charles, who himself, who was just ascended to the throne, had to trace his family straight to Woden himself in order to be accepted. You know, you have to show lineage in all of these kingships, right? And so there was the same thing. You can't break the genealogies because then you wouldn't get the kings. And the main basis for the spread of Christianity was the conversion of the kings. They would just go to the right to the head. You know, they wouldn't go and try to like walk door to door. A lot of this stuff about like there were, you know, all these wars and stuff like that that took place, that was not what happened. They would go in and they would show the king, you know, an immense amount of wealth, all of this stuff that he could get, all the connections to Rome, everything that all the benefits he would gain from becoming Christian, and then he would convert, and then he would force the people to worship the new God, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was the time, every time that's what you saw, right?
Yeah.
And so the But they still had their genealogy, and they're like, you can't break my genealogy. I mean, literally my grandfather's on this thing, like you can't just destroy that. So what do? You know, you say, well, okay, well, they're not the early guys on that genealogy list. Those are not gods. Those are just humans. That's why you have your genealogy. Right. And so it takes away their divine right. Right. But it also discredits the gods, you know, so they have to figure out what, well, your divine right comes through Jesus and God, and we're going to bless you through the church and the Vatican and all that stuff. And they have to replace all that.
Yeah. You know? So your divinity doesn't come from Woden. Your divinity comes from Jehovah. And it just so happens that, you know, your distant ancestor Woden was some great king a long time ago.
Right. Right. And so like, this school of thought, you know, like I said, it became the Prosetta. It uses this as its format. Snorri actually uses what's called the Latin dialogue method. And this is why, you know, you see it in there is like, there's Gylfi and he's talking to you know, High and Just as High and Third, or Har, Jafnhar and Thridi, right? And these are the different names of Odin. And they're having this dialogue throughout the entire book, which is called Gylfaginning, right? Now, Gylfaginning means the tricking of Gylfi, which directly connects it to this idea of Christian euhemerism, because the whole idea of Christian euhemerism is that these ancient kings tricked people into believing that they were gods, right? Wow. And it literally at the end of Gylfaginning, it shows that at the very end, like they all disappear and he sees that they weren't really gods and it's all just a big illusion and all that stuff, you know, and, you know, and in the beginning of it, the whole thing breaks down like the biblical story and all that. I mean, Snorri was a Christian. He wasn't a cryptic pagan. He wasn't like somebody trying to save the religion. These guys were people who were writing down a common theme that had been existed. He just did it better. He just had a better, more detailed story because the Icelanders were such great record keepers, you know?
Yeah.
And he didn't humorize it as much as Saxo and Jordanes and a lot of these other guys.
You know? Yeah. If I could just interject there, just, you know, some of the listeners might not be familiar with Snorri Sturluson, but and this is real beginner stuff. But Snorri Sturluson, kept the Poetic Edda. He restored it, right? He reintroduced it to Icelandic society, and then what's the generally Prosetta. Believed is that he sorry,
the Prosetta.
The Poetic Edda, he took it. It's generally believed that he took the Poetic Edda and essentially kind of wrote the Prose Edda based on that. But there are,
but there are
quite some differences between the two. And I'd never really thought about the fact that, I mean, because he does, it's in the Prose Edda where Snorri prefaces it by talking about how the Norse gods were, you know, involved, the, you know, that. What is he likens the Asir to Asia. Is that Snorri that does that?
Right.
He says they come from Asia. They're related to Troy, to the Trojans, things like this. So he was letting his Christianity, his Christian beliefs, kind of pervert his understanding of Norse law. So would you say then that the Prose Edda is kind of, for the most part, to be seen as a perversion, or do you think that there is more good than bad in it?
It's difficult to say. I mean, you just have to critique it. You have to take on a step by step, line by line basis, you know, because there's a lot of great stuff in the Prose Edda. But there are like literal times when we see him, you know, like, I mean, William Reeves has helped me, and we've listed like at least 30 times where he like directly contradicts the Poetic Edda. And that's your litmus. Like, I always try to tell people, have a litmus, have a true north, right?
And if you see something,
if you see him contradicting the Poetic Edda, then he's wrong. That's it, period. You know, because the Poetic Edda is a heathen source. Yeah, there's a couple poems and stuff like that where like the Solariod and stuff like that they have that are obviously Christian. The first thing you have to overcome really is this whole idea of a Christianized you know, Poetic Edda. And we'll go into that in the next school of thought, right? But because that's and even like a lot of mainstream scholars are starting to realize that, like Jackson Crawford is making video and says that the whole Christianized Poetic Edda thing is largely exaggerated. It's just stuff that people made up because you're talking to people who are Christians at Christian universities who are writing this stuff, and they see the Bible as the epicenter of everything. You know, and so when they're looking at Völuspá and they see an end of the world scenario, they're, well, that's got to be, you know, the Armageddon. That's got to be the apocalypse, Really? Why? You know, well, because it's similar. You know, there's an end of the world here. There's an end of the world there. So they must be the same. You know?
Everything gets and looked at like, through the lens of a post-Christian world, right? And that affects everything about how we view the ancient law, and not just the ancient Norse Germanic law, but Celtic and Persian and everything. It all gets viewed through this post-Christian lens. And it's very difficult for us to see the world the way that our ancestors saw it when we're actually looking at what texts did survive from them through a Christian lens.
Right. Well, perfect example of that is like, you know, a lot of people, I don't know when you're going to air this, but today is Easter for Christians, right? And for the longest time, these scholars refused, like straight out refused. You can look in older dictionaries and stuff like that. They refused to say that the word Easter comes from the Anglo-Saxon dawn goddess, right? They refused to mention Eostre. They would say that the word Easter comes from Esther of the Bible, who was originally a Babylonian goddess, a mother goddess like Frigga, you know, and her name was Astarte. And in all of their etymologies, Ishtar, like for a longest, for the longest time, they would just say that was the etymology of it. And these are the people who were like the main guys. So people reading that stuff and like, oh yeah, that's the etymology. No, it's not. It's literally her name is Easter. Anglo-Saxon word Easter is Easter, and that's it.
And it's still contested. It's still contested to this day. I mean, a friend of mine linked me to a video the other day of a Christian guy trying to disprove the pagan origins of Easter, talking about Bede being, and Bede is the main source for the information we have about Eostre or the goddess Easter, talking about how his attestations are uncertain and all of this kind of stuff. And then, getting pernickety about the dates that these things co-align on, Easter and Pascha, as most countries call Easter, which is after the Judaic Passover. So even to this day, it's contested. And you're right, Mark. That's a really good example that you've given there about how seeing things through a Christian lens can actually hinder our connection to our ancestral ways.
Right. They do. And that's what the next school is, the biblical school, right? It's founded by Sophus Buge. And Sophus Buge, he just basically saw everything as being manifested through Christianity, And so he was one of the original people who, transliterated the Poetic Edda and had a hold of the texts and all that stuff. And those guys were respected scholars. I mean, you have to look at the world that they were in at the time. We can't just like attack them, We have to be critical of it. And so you already have two schools of thought we've gone over. The interpretatio school, which said that none of these gods were native, that they were all just Roman or Greek gods, right? Then you have the second one, which is the euhemerist school, which says that none of the gods are real. They're all just men, right? And then the biblical school says that all the gods in your lore are all just biblical characters. Like they've made the argument that Baldur is Jesus and Odin is Jesus and Thor is Jesus and everybody's Jesus. And it just goes on and on. I mean, it's like, and this school is still taken seriously in some parts of academia. We still see some of its theories pop up. And it's just the most ridiculous, arbitrary connections. Like I remember one that Rydberg kind of broke down was the connection of Thor fishing out Jormungandr from the ocean and Jesus fishing Leviathan, and it's like so arbitrary. There's no connection there whatsoever. And yet the only thing is that there's fishing happening and there's a snake, everything else is different. Like it's like the snake is the devil and Jesus uplifts his sin. I don't remember the whole aspect of it, but there's no connection to it whatsoever. But they made a big deal about that. Like, it's the same. It's exactly the same. It's the same thing, And it's like the whole idea is that these people are just people who see their religion as the center of everything, And so when Rydberg started writing his books, and this kind of goes into our epic school of it, but when Rydberg did this, they came to Rydberg and asked him to study this because Rydberg was a religious scholar, right? And so he approached the religion as a religion, and he's the only person that ever did that. And that's why we built this school around him, because we want to see this as a religion. And we'll go more into that as we're going through the schools, right? But he actually challenged Sophus Buge and sent him his researches, and Sophus Bugge like admitted defeat. We have that. We put the paragraph in a letter that Sophus wrote and said, like, I wish that I was seeing your researches before now, because I can only admit now that I'm just a philologist and that this is a monumental. I mean, he just basically admits, like, oh my God, like, what was I thinking, you know? Yeah. And so the thing is that, you know, you see it then. So now we have three. You know, the interpretatio, it's not native. Euhemerus, it's all kings. They're not real. And then the third one, the biblical school, is that it's all biblical characters.
Yeah, before you move on to the next one, Mark, I think even today, I do see some Christians who, in trying to kind of dismantle or subvert the idea of, not the idea, the reality of heathenry or paganism, they'll say things like, okay, so you have these multiple gods. Who is their God? You know, who is the override? Who created everything? You know, for example, the Hindus, you know, they have something like, I think it's 30,000 or 30 million different gods, something like that. They say they have, but they do believe in this one overarching deity. And I believe it's in the Bhagavad Gita. And then Krishna talks about how he is the only deity worth that really needs to be worshipped. He is the overarching deity. So I think I have come across Christians before who will say, okay, you have these gods, but they are just aspects or misunderstandings of our one Jehovah God. So they'll come at it from that angle, because they can't allow for a folk tradition to remain unclaimed by Judeo-Christianity, by the Abrahamic religions. They need to somehow, as you say, kind of take control of it, to make it the center of all thought, all belief, all existence. So they need to supplant their Abrahamic religion on top of our faith. And that's another way that they do it.
Right. Well, I mean, but there's philosophical ways for us to argue for polytheism. I mean, because I do agree with the idea that there needs to be some form of first cause, right? There has to be some sort of constant in the universe. But for us, that constant is very natural. It's the elements. The elements are the constant. You know, when we see it in Voluspa, it's the very first thing. It says there was no sand or sea or cool waves. There was just Ganungagap, right? And Ganungagap had fire and ice, and that came together and that formed life. And you know, and that constant cycle of existence we see throughout the lore and throughout our faith. The elements are our constant. And you see this, like there's a like a one element that's a part of it called Ur, right? Yeah. It's A-U-R-R. And this is like a sacred substance that like creates life. You know, the Ur is the substance that Odumla, the cow, you know, she basically feeds upon this when she licks the ice. It's within the ice. And then Ymir drinks it from her teats, and then he sweats out the first beings, and she licks from the ice and creates the Ur that's in the ice, creates Bori, who becomes the first god. And all of this stuff shows that the elements are this constant. And so that's our first cause.
But even when we're going to accept that there is an original creative force, why would we call it by the name of a religion that came into Europe from without? You know, it's in a sense, what I'm saying is that monotheism doesn't have to be Abrahamic. And I'm not saying that ours is a monotheistic way at all, but I'm saying that if Christians are going to argue that there is ultimately one overarching creator, even if we're going to accept that, which of course in some ways as you've just described we do, that doesn't mean that we're going to start calling it Yahweh or Jehovah,
right? Or that it even, I think that the concept of it is like for our ancestors, the overall reaching sort of omnipotent force in the universe was more neutral, because the problem with it, right, and Christians have tried to delineate this and break it down and create all kinds of weird theories and stuff like that, is that in order for something to be omnipotent and be so far reaching and all that stuff, they say it has to be outside of time and space. But being outside of time and space is impossible, especially if you are trying to intervene in human affairs. Okay. Mm. So like you look at like, if you're intervening, then you immediately become part of time and space, you know, because you have a past, present, and future. Then if you intervene today, well, yesterday you weren't the guy who intervened, and tomorrow you'll be the guy who did intervene. So you're past, present, and future right then, you know, you just entered time and space, you know? And so that's the thing about it, is that like, we see the gods as like higher powers, as higher forms, as higher forms of existence within the natural realm. And as science grows and grows and grows, and we see that multiplicity is the expression of nature. There is no oneness. I mean, we just see it. And it's like these people see these discoveries, they just ignore them. You know, a lot of the people who believe in oneness and all the connections of everything, it's like seeing the forest, but not seeing the trees ever, like refusing that there are even trees. You know, it's only the forest. And it's like, it's ridiculous because we break down things in a molecular level and we break the molecules open. There's stuff in there that's even smaller. And we break it down even smaller. If we can go down in that direction, we can go up, you know, and then life becomes higher and becomes more intelligent, becomes more immortal. It has these things that are creative within it that helps to make us who we are. And that's why we worship the gods.
Yeah. 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 So what do we got next? Animism, what did you want to talk about next?
I wanted to finish the schools of thought, right?
Yeah, please.
And so we're entering the modern era now. The last two schools of thought are the modern era, right? And these are, a lot of these schools are the basis of like New Ageism and a lot of the things that we've had stumbling blocks as the heathen community, because New Ageism is like literally probably the biggest challenge that we have, you know? And I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I'm saying, you know, we've lived with these excuses for so long. We don't have this. We can't do that. We don't have this. Can't do that. And then it's like, now we're discovering that we can. So it's time to move forward. It's time to evolve. It's time to take the next step and say, we can practice the traditional faith. And people who want to rebel against that and say, no, we're not going to do that, we're going to follow this thing that we've been doing for the last 30 years or whatever, then it's time for those people to be honest with the people who follow them and honest with themselves and say, I don't want to follow an ancestral tradition. That's just not what I want to do. I want to do what I've been doing, and I like that, and I'm going to keep doing that. And that's fine. Do it. That's your business, you know? But for me, I'm here to follow the ancestral tradition, the faith of my ancestors. And I see that faith as like being a part of a chain of existence that was broken, and then we have to reforge that link so we can move on with it, right? And that's the basis of that. Now, the first school is the nature school. Okay. Now, the nature school was started by a guy named Max Müller, who first started his researches into the Vedic religion. And Hindus really don't like Max Müller. At least most of them, they really, really don't like that guy, because he was a Lutheran who, you know, just saw all our religions as savage and brutal religions and were just ridiculous farces and all this stuff. And he created the concept of a noumena, right? Which is basically names become nomina, or no, it's nomina become noumena, right? Nomina are the names. And then that becomes a phenomenon, right? And connects to that. And so basically what he's saying is that something is named something after a phenomenon, and that naming makes it a god. It gets personified, right? So Thor becomes the thunder.
Is this the idea that we created our own god, that we created our gods?
Yeah, basically from weather phenomenon. You know, we'd experience the weather, we'd get scared of the thunder, and we'd start worshiping it, you know, which is absurd. Mm. It's the whole thing is so ridiculous. Victor Rydberg took that school, and that was one of the main focuses he had, because the archetypal school wasn't around yet. And he just decimated it. He tears it apart, because he shows how their conclusions are so arbitrary that you can make anything into anything you want it to. You know, like when they say Huther is a symbol of darkness and Baldur is a symbol of light and you know, and it's a symbol of winter overcoming summer and all this different stuff. You know, it's just like pull it out of the sky and make it whatever you want to, because it seems like it could be this. And it's based on this model this guy created that isn't anything. You know, it's literally based on air. It's based on nothing. It's just his opinion. And a lot of scholars liked it because your opinion matters if you have a PhD, you know.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's because we research these things like very thoroughly. And a lot of times, you know, academics, they like being gatekeepers, you know. I don't know if that's nefarious or anything like that. I'm just saying it's what happens, you know. So it's much better to say, oh, you're the guy with a PhD, I need to listen to you because you have the information, right? But then when you actually crack it apart and look at the theory and what it actually is, you see that there's nothing to it. You know, so people it starts becoming like the, you know, I don't know if everybody's seen the meme of the guy who's got like the board and he's got all the pins in it and all the strings connected to the pins. And he's like,
yeah.
Like it's that. It's just literally strings and pins. And look at this. This connects to this and that connects to that. And this connects to that and all that stuff. Right. And there's no methodology to it. It's just like what we feel is a similarity to something, you know, rather than like, can we build an argument around it? Can we prove it? You know, well, this seems similar to this. This is named after this. The word Thor does mean thunder. It does have a connection to thunder. But does that mean that Thor is the thunder? You know, and if you talk to people in other polytheist religions who have thunder gods and sky gods and earth mothers and stuff like that, they don't see it that way. You know, they see these as gods, as divinities that have power and dominion over those things, but aren't the actual phenomena.
Yeah, I picked up a translation of the Havamal by Cyrus Gorgani recently, and I really enjoyed his translation. And one of the things he talks about in the introduction to it is how most of, if not all of, the previous translators of the Poetic Edda and the Havamal and the commentators on it are themselves not practicing pagans. They're not heathens. You know, they speak with authority about our sacred texts when they don't even believe in it.
Right. And that's the problem. That's why I'm showing these schools of thought. That's why it's so important that people see this, because this is what happens when you allow outsiders to study your faith. And like I said, with the Hindus, they don't tolerate it. Like, they told Max Müller, you know, don't study our stuff. These are our sacred scriptures. Don't mess with it. You got all you Western scholars need to stay out of it. You know, and that's what we need to start telling these guys. You don't belong here. This isn't your faith. You don't appreciate it. You don't value it. And all of your academic thoughts have been nothing but deconstructionists. They're all there to try to prove that it doesn't exist, that it's not real, or it's not native, or it's not whatever it's supposed to be. It's something else, you know? And that's why the Epic School is here, because we are all practicing members. We're all practicing of the faith, you know? And so, like, that goes into the final school of the academics, is the archetypal school. Now, the archetypal school is the kind of the most difficult one to explain, because we don't want to try to discredit the works of Carl Jung, right? Carl Jung was a brilliant psychoanalyst. The guy was, the stuff that he was doing was incredible. And I try to tell people, like, the way that Jung was doing it was sort of from the outside looking in, right? He was trying to see how these myths and these stories and these symbols affected the human mind. And that's why he, you know, talks about archetypes and stuff like that. And that is a real thing. Like, that's helped people. So you can't deny its reality. But what the archetypal school did, the mythic school of archetypal study, people like Campbell and a lot of other guys, they flipped it and they went from the inside looking out, right? And basically said that all these gods are just figments of your imagination, and they're just, you know, they're just symbols, and they don't really represent anything. They're not real gods. It's not a real religion. It's all just fake, right?
It's just a tool for self-improvement kind of thing.
Right, exactly, you know? And that became the basis for, you know, the modern New Age movement. I mean, Wicca is basically nothing other than an archetypal cult.
Yeah.
You see them and they're talking about the mother and the father and the trickster and all this stuff. It's just nonsense. It's just like, it's just archetypes, you know, and they don't really mean anything. There is no tradition behind it. There is no lineage to it. It's just what we feel it should be, you know? And so with these schools of thought, I mean, like I said, you know, if we want to be practicing our ancestral religion, because that's what it is, a religion, then we have to look at it as a religion, and we have to use the methods that develop it as a tradition. And so, you know, we've created a hierarchy of sources. We've created a rock solid methodology. We've created, you know, tons of arguments on and built theories upon things that we can prove and have evidence for. Right. And then we practice the faith, you know, and we're trying to teach people how to the things that they want to do, like how this can be done in a way that's connected to the sources, relates from the ancestral material, connects to archaeology, connects to the things that we see, you know. And so that's really why we're doing all this.
So, we've talked a lot about Viktor Rydberg, and understandably so. He's obviously quite central to the work that you do with the Norrøna Society. And I'm definitely going to be kind of fast tracking his work that you mentioned up my reading pile, because it's clearly of great importance. I mean, I really liked what you said earlier about how he was the kind of first academic to come along to actually prove the faith rather than to disprove it, like all of the others were doing.
Right.
So you've mentioned the epic method, and this is something that you have developed. Is that in partnership with William Reeves of Germanic mythology? Or so, could you just explain a little bit more about what the epic method is, how it works, and the power of it?
Well, the main thing is, is that it's, you know, like I said, we have the hierarchy of sources, right? Starting with the Poetic Edda, the Prose Edda is right behind it. Saxo Grammaticus is in there, you know, the sagas, all this stuff, understanding this hierarchy and knowing that one can't contradict one higher up on the hierarchy, right?
Yeah.
And so if you understand that, you can start to see a pattern unfolding, right? And basically what we do is, some people have said that like we're basically like comparative mythologists, but we're just comparing in the Germanic realm, right? Mm. So we're not like trying to compare the world religions, just this. And so we show how like, you know, this tradition here is also found in these sources, and it creates these lines of convergence. And we just keep building those lines and keep building those lines. And we can show people a consistency within all those sources, and then how that, how they're related. And some people have tried to discredit that by saying, well, they're just, you know, reading the same books as other people and they're just copying it and all that stuff. But it's like, or they have a consistent tradition that they're chronicling, you know.
So, for example, if there's a rite or a belief or a character, you know, a god or a white who appears in both the Poetic and the Prose Edda and Heimskringla, then that gives more authority to that particular aspect of the belief, right? And that gets pushed up the kind of you know, your kind of order of priority as to what the religion really is about. Yeah, we can know for sure if something is attested in three or four different Germanic sources, you know, and then maybe attested again in the Anglo-Saxon poems or riddles or whatever, then we can know for certain that that is something that our ancestors absolutely, definitely did believe.
Yeah, absolutely. And what that did was it allowed us to look at the chronology by trying to understand the lore from all the different sources. And then that's how the Austro Edda developed. Now, the Austro Edda was written a long time ago, and we're definitely going to be updating that research. But the there was just a chronology that we saw there, and we are putting that. Now, Victor Rydberg was the one who developed the chronology, but we kind of, you know, built upon that, and I wouldn't say perfected it, but got a much closer. And we tried to eliminate a lot of the interpretations. Like when you see the Our Father's God saga, like I said, Rydberg was just writing it to the youth. So he puts a lot of his own interpretations into it, a lot of his own just sort of storytelling artistry into it. Whereas we were actually taking the original sources and just putting them in there, you know. And so the idea of that is that, you know, we can be able to read our lore and understand our lore that's pieced together in this epic and see the epic. And it's the thing I tell people, is like, dude, once you read it, you can't unsee the epic, you know. Once you've seen it, it's there. And then you're going to read the Poetic Edda again, and you'll be like, oh my God, like this is all just fitting here and there and connected to this. And it's just, there's so many different aspects and so many different theories in it that just, you know, they kind of fly in the face of what you typically see in academia. But it also has a lot more argument around it. And there's a lot more like connection and looking over specific lines and words. And when you start to look in the Old Norse, when you're actually looking in the manuscripts in the Old Norse, you see things that the academics just like completely pass over, you know, that change the complete context of a verse. Like one of the ones in Havamal that, you know, we've shown is it's a real famous one. The cattle die, kinsmen die, you yourself shall die. One thing that I know never dies is the reputation over each one dead. Well, the word there is domer, right? It doesn't mean reputation. It means judgment. They're talking about the judgment of the dead, right? At the Helthing, which is a thing of judgment that you go before the gods and they judge you and determine your afterlife, right? And this thing of the dead is shown in like Grimnismal and in Ynglinga saga and all this stuff. This is a thing of judgment of the dead. People were like, first heard that, they were like, oh my God, no, that's crazy. That's Christian. We don't get judged in death and all that stuff. And I'm like, look, man, all right, first off, whenever you're seeing somebody say that, right, rather than making an emotional response, look at, first off, is that just a Christian concept, right? Does polytheism allow for judgment and death? And that's the first thing you do. So we did that. You can go look it up on Wikipedia and all of the Google or whatever, and you'll see that every single polytheist religion in the world has a concept of an afterlife judgment. All of them do. There's not a single one that doesn't.
I'm so glad you mentioned that as an example, because that's a real aha moment. That's a real light bulb moment for me, because one of the things that I've often said about when talking to people about why My heathen beliefs are, I believe, more beneficial to the folk than Christianity. One of the reasons is that I say that as a heathen, you can't live a life of misconduct and as the Christians would call sin. But as long as you repent on your deathbed, you know, you get to go into the kingdom of the Father, etc. Our actions are written into the fabric of weird from day one, and nothing we can do will erase any of our actions throughout our lifetime. And of course, none of us are going to live perfect lives and making honorable decisions every moment of the way. But what matters is at the end of it, we aim for a situation where, on balance, we are deemed to have lived a good enough life by the gods. And, right. Years ago, I studied a little bit of just a very kind of superficial level of Egyptian law. And the ancient Egyptians had this concept of the crossing of the Duat, which is crossing this void to reach the afterlife. But before they crossed the Duat, their heart was weighed, and I forget by which deity it was weighed, but this is depicted in loads of Egyptian hieroglyphs where there's literally the weighing of the heart, the weighing of a man's soul, the weighing of a man's deeds. So, right. I love the fact that you use that example, because that verse from Havamal, that is often used as an example of how, essentially of how materialistic our heathen faith is, that actually it's just, you know, there is no afterlife, but it's just that the memory of what you do in your life is what matters. But what you're saying is that actually this very much ties into the kind of permanence of our being.
Right. And the thing is that when you start looking at these other religions and you start seeing that they all have an afterlife and they all have a judgment in the afterlife and all that stuff, then it makes you accountable. And the one thing that just irks me so much, right, is that these things have real world implications. I've had people who were like, veterans and people who were just older people who were like on their deathbed, and they contact me and they thank me because they're like, before you came around, I practiced this religion for years, but there was no answers. When you're just touting gross and true garbage, that's just straight out of Snorri, you die you in battle, you go to Valhalla, if you don't, you go to hell and all that stuff, and you don't understand what hell is, you don't understand what the underworld is, you don't understand the judgment of the dead, then you just tell people some nonsense like that, then they start to fade away and they're like, what's going to happen to me? I don't know what's going on. And think of how much harm that has caused, And they come to me and they thank me and they're like, you gave me a reason to live. And now that I'm dying, it's okay. It's all good. And it's like that stuff like that is telling you, this is not a game. This is not something we're playing at. We're not playing Viking here. We're dealing with real things and real people's lives. And so when you actually have an eschatology that will teach people the answers to life and existence and meaning and being, then that creates a culture that empowers you and gives you something, a reason to exist.
And it becomes less and less of a game as you start to face your mortality more and more. So obviously as you age, it's easy for these kind of young guys who like the Viking aesthetic, the whole, as you say, brosetry thing. It's easy to kind of treat it as a game then, but when things get more serious, when you have a family, when you start to face up to your own mortality, then you do need answers to these questions. And I think a lot of heathens actually feel kind of stupid asking them. I remember in my early years of researching the ancestral faith, I was searching on web forums, and this is probably like 15 years ago, and I was trying to find information about the afterlife, and the consensus that was coming back is that there is no afterlife. The pagans don't believe in an afterlife, and it's this kind of animistic thing of, or we just become, we become part of the earth and we nourish the fungi and the trees and the roots, and that is our afterlife, but understanding the law in the way that you do and the way that you're presenting it, it is incredibly empowering, because it means that we aren't just these kind of these flames which flicker for a few years and then die out forever. There's a much grander scope to our existence.
Right. And you see that throughout the Indo-European diaspora. You know, you see all of these religions having this. Like you look at the Greeks, I mean, they had the Elysian fields and they had Tartarus.
Yeah.
You know, and there was an idea of a blessed afterlife and a damnation, you know. And the idea is to be a good person and to make up for your wrongs. You know, that's it's always important for us to understand the difference then for the people who scream Christianity, you know, because the difference is that Christianity would abhors religions like this because they call them religions of works, right? When you base it on a morality, right, on a code of ethics that you have to follow, and that when you follow that code of ethics, you will be blessed with a good afterlife. They call that a religion of works, and that negates Christianity because for them it's a religion of grace, and it doesn't matter what you do, right? They, you have to follow the law because Jesus tells you to, but it has no bearing upon your afterlife whatsoever. And that's a misnomer a lot of Christians have, because they think in the popular culture Christianity has been taught, you know, Christianity has been teaching that if you're a good person you go to heaven, if you're a bad person you go to hell, blah blah. But that's not true at all, and any religious scholar will tell you that. That it's based upon the grace of their God, not your moral standing, right? And so it's like you were saying before, and I forgive anybody for me getting graphic here for a second, right? But like the best way to argue against that is Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Who was a guy who was a psychopath who went and raped little kids and actually took one 14-year-old boy and drilled a hole into his skull so that he could turn him into a sex slave, a zombie, right? And this guy got saved before he died. So he gets to go to heaven, right? And it's like, that's the kind of person that you are dealing with. That's the way that morality works. Because if you just get saved, then off you go. You found Jesus. He's in your heart. You're a good person now.
You paid your lip service. Right? Yeah, you paid your lip service, exactly. And now you're in. Yes.
Yeah. Whereas in our religion, you're going to get tortured in all kinds of really horrible ways because you deserve it.
Yeah. And I know which afterlife destination I'd rather end up in. You know, one where people have earned it, or one where people have just said the right thing at the moment before death to get there.
Right. And that's the thing. It's like it's weighed. It's based on your decisions and the actions that you take. And making, I mean, and it's not to say you don't have wrongs. We have the concept of son, which is atonement, right? And atonement is like how you right wrongs, you know, and you have to atone, you have to face justice, you have to deal with things directly. And that's it, you know? And, this is a prevalent concept. Another concept that we faced off with people that was put out there for a long time. And I really appreciate, I wanted to kind of segue this with this is that, a lot of times we get questions from people, right? And I value questions from people when they ask me things, because some of these questions have led into just massive amounts of work, like research that just took us into so many amazing directions. And this one, somebody came to me and it was a game changer, because they came to me and asked me, what are the sources for us refusing to kneel before the gods, right? And I was like, I don't know. And like at the time, you know, this was a while back, long time ago, I thought that it was just sort of the way it was, you know, that we don't kneel before the gods, that we stand before them, you know, as equals, and we raise our hands up to them and all that stuff. And I was like, okay, well, let me go look and I'll find it and I'll bring it back to you. But when I went and studied it, like, not only was that not there, but there's like 15 sources that say that you do kneel before the gods and you prostrate before them and you were devotional and it's sacred and all that stuff. And it was just source after source after source. And I was like, what is this? Like, why have we been told this? Why have people been telling us this? Well, it's because you had libertine Satanists in the 70s writing books and stuff like that. And they projected their own worldview into it of, you know, this is just be libertarian. It's just be whatever you want, you know, the counterculture movement and all that stuff. And it's like they're putting that out there and not actually putting research into it. And I remember one of the books that I read on it talked about might and main. Right. Mm-hmm. That we should value our own might and main. Now, this is very important. So if you ever hear anybody write about this or talk about this, right, know where it comes from. So this is from a saga. And I don't remember which saga, but it's from a saga where a guy he's talking to a Gathi. Right. And he's talking to the Gathi and he tells him, hey, we're about to perform the sacrifice. Are you going to come and sacrifice with us? And he says, no, I don't sacrifice to the gods. I believe in my own might and main, right? And then he says something nasty, and the god, he basically says, well, that's blasphemy. And he actually has the guy brought before the thing and has him charged and tried as a blasphemer, and he gets outlawed for it. Well, the guy gets mad and he goes and finds the Gothi at his hof and murders him at the hof, right? So here's a sacred site, which is never have blood spilled upon it. This guy murders one of our sacred priesthood, and he blasphemes our gods. And this is the person that everybody, that these guys say, that's the model we should follow. Well,
that's incredible. This is, I think this comes out of, you know, and I kind of fell victim to this earlier on. There are these kind of pervasive myths that come with heathenry, especially for people who haven't looked into it in detail in the way that someone like yourself has. A lot of people come to it from this kind of Nietzschean angle, right? You know, someone like myself, you know, I was essentially introduced to Germanic heathenry through the early black metal music that I listened to. You know, this is a genre of music that came out of Norway in the early 90s. And you had guys like Varg Vikernes from Burzum, and he was using runes as the imagery on his artwork, and he was he was writing albums called Hlidskaf and things like this. You know, he was referring to the Norse lore. And this was really my introduction. But a lot of those black metal guys, for them, paganism is just a means of defying Christianity. That's all it is, right? You know, and in the early days, it comes from this very Nietzschean, like, will to power, I am my own God, I don't kneel before anyone kind of thing. Right. And that kind of attitude, it is difficult to, especially when it's the reason that you were attracted to it in the first place. It can take a few years to kind of get over that, and to find, especially when you find that out, that actually things like kneeling, the example that you give there, we should be kneeling, and it feels like when you've got into it from an anti-Christian point of view initially, and then you're told actually you do kneel before your gods like the Christians kneel before their God, it can be a bit galling, you know, these kind of things. But that's where you need to have this intellectual honesty, and you need to accept it for what it is rather than trying to change or interpret it for what you want it to be.
Right. And it comes with a level of maturity, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. I was there too, man. I grew up on metal and all these different bands, and I like that stuff. And I've been to like 1,000 different shows and stuff like that, you know. And that was a part of my life and culture and all that stuff. But like, it's at some point we have to grow up as a religion and as people, you know. And we have to realize that we're not here to be rebels. We're not here to try to fight the status quo. We're here to practice our ancestral religion,
to
no matter what
the
it
true
is.
Status quo, yeah,
right. Because this was at one time Europe, you know, and it's like we see the Romans and the Greeks; they knelt before their gods, and you know, and all other polytheist religions around the world have no issue with this. There's no problem with it, and it's like that's really what helps you is looking at these other religions, because that breaks apart the whole concept of like, is this Christian or not? You know, that was one of the really big forms of research that sort of developed that broke down a lot of the biblical school stuff and a lot of things that were growing through that was the Indo-European research, because that Indo-European research really tore apart a lot of this stuff, you know, because they started showing that not only was the etymology the same and the connections were the same, but the religion was the same. And there were so many different avenues where all of this stuff sort of intertwined that it just, like, the biblical school just melted, you know. And so that's how we see these things and how we look at it, you know? Yeah. And so when you're seeing like the Hindus and stuff, like, I mean, they're very devout. They kneel before their gods. They worship in devotion and all that stuff. And that stuff is not like, you know, oh, it came from Islam or something like that. No, I mean, it's all the way, this is the way it always was. We see it in the Vedas. They talk about kneeling before the gods. This is like as far back as you can see, this is what it is, you know? And that's why we say like, this is just a counterculture thing. It's not to disparage that, because we always, what we want to do is we always appreciate and value those who have come before us. You know, our movement is new. It's, you know, it started in like 1920s and stuff like that in Australia. And then it moved forward in the 60s and the 70s, and people have to evolve. Like when Alexander Rudd Mills and those guys in Australia were developing their things, the first thing they did was create a church. They created the Anglican Church of Odin, right? And it's like, I don't think any of us today would create the Anglican Church of anything, you know? But that's where they were. They were like, these guys were just like, what do we do? Let's do this, you know? And so like, then it evolved and people started getting more into the understanding of it, and they sought to try to rebuild it and get to where they are. But then it's like, it's time for the next stage where we get closer, where we start, because the thing about this is that it's not just about like being right. Right. That's not the point of this at all. And I know some people think that that's what we're trying to do. Let's be right. You know, the point of this is that if you begin to really reconstruct the religion, then you're unfolding something. It's like opening a Pandora's box. You're opening up so much more, because then you have a philosophy. Then you have, you know, a cosmology and an eschatology, and you can start answering those big questions for people. You can stand on the world stage with Christianity and Islam and Hinduism and Buddhism and debate them and stand there as, and show them that our faith is just as valid as any others. Right. And that's not something that anybody has ever been able to do, because no. I mean, as far as in the neo-pagan movement, because it's all just whatever you want to do, man. You know, it's like it's just like, don't follow the rules and we're just rebelling and we're just this. But it's like, dude, we're talking about big boy religion, and it's time to put on your big boy pants, because when you start showing people philosophy and you debate them and you show them what this is, then it really starts to come together. And then that's how you build culture and community and nations and everything that we're trying to do.
Yeah. And I'll give you another example of why it's so important to reconstruct it the way that you're doing it. And by the way, I do really appreciate the way that you are always constantly looking to reassess and improve your work, even to the extent that you're kind of rewriting books and things like that. And I think that's wonderfully, it's wonderfully honest, and it's wonderfully important. And I think, you know, I think that's the perfect attitude to have. But in my experience, since becoming kind of a somewhat kind of minor spokesman about paganism and things, and running this podcast and that, I get emails from people who want to know how to become a pagan or a heathen. One of the main obstacles for most people, and I'll admit, even for myself, to a small degree to this day, you know, and I've been a practicing heathen for about 12 years. Before that, I was kind of, you know, I was understanding the runes. I was doing rune casting things. But when I talk about as a practicing heathen, going to moots, performing rites with other people. So about 12 years, but even to this day, you know, I have this, well, it's not so much me, but the people who contact me, they say, I feel kind of stupid doing these things. You know, stepping out into their garden where maybe they've got family members who can watch what they're doing, you know, and performing a feigning or a bloat or whatever. They feel like it's kind of LARPing, it's make-believe. They don't feel confident in what they're doing to, you know, they think that people are mocking and judging what they're doing. And that's because, you know, a Hindu or, you know, follower of Sanatana Dharma or a Zoroastrian or a Muslim, they wouldn't think for a moment about performing their rites with absolute conviction, sincerity, deadly serious. But right. Heathens, because of, you know, because we've grown up in this Christian, and then, you know, I would say for quite a long time now, we've essentially lived in atheist societies, particularly in Europe. I know in America, Christianity is still pretty strong, but in Europe, it's pretty much dead these days. So we have these very scientific mindsets, and we view everything with irony, and it's very difficult for us to recreate something ancient like that with absolute conviction and confidence. But what you're offering through the work that you're doing with the Nirvana Society and others as well, you know, I would say that the Theodish Belief guys as well, they're doing it in a similar way, reconstructing what we know of the ancient lore in enough detail that we can know with absolute certainty that when we step outside into that sacred space and we are on a high holy tide or whatever, and we perform a feigning or a blot, that we are doing something that our ancestors absolutely did do. Okay, maybe we're not doing it 100% perfectly, exactly as they would do. But then the same right. can be said for Hindus, probably. You know, I imagine that there are going to be slight discrepancies between the way that Hindus practice now and what their ancestors did, you know, 1,000 years ago. Right. So it's really important that we offer that, that it's kind of like an enormous cushion that we're giving people to know that, you are doing the right thing by performing things in this manner, leaving no kind of gaps and holes and doubt for people to wonder whether what they're doing actually means anything.
Right. And the thing is about it is that I think that what we're doing and what, you know, people like Ari Akasha and Survive the Jive and the Fear and Sidhu guys and Theodosh Folk and a lot of great organizations out there are doing is trying to understand it first, you know, because when you're just going out and just performing ceremonies, and I think that's why a lot of times it does feel silly for people, is a lot of times it's putting the cart before the horse, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Because you want to know why you're doing it before you
absolutely
do it, you know?
Yeah, great point. And so 100%.
That's really the difference between reenactment and reconstruction. Because reenactment is a very materialist way of looking at things, right? It's like, I just need to have the right spoon, or I need to have the right clothing, or I need to have the right this, that, and the other, right? And when you're looking at reconstruction, what you're trying to do is create theological arguments for the things that you're doing,
yes,
right? Yeah. So that these things have a validity to them in your life. And so they mean something. If you're just doing it just to do it, then yeah, it's going to feel silly because you're like, I'm out there in this weird costume and I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm just following this formula somebody gave me, and I'm reading off a piece of paper, and I don't have a priesthood, and I don't have this, that, and the other. And it makes it where it does feel like LARPing, you know. But so what we've done is, you know, we actually tackled this because we wanted to understand, why do we bloat, right? Mm-hmm. What is the purpose behind it? And the thing that we came up with, and we really, I think we built a pretty solid argument around it, is that it very much ties into the lore, okay? And that is that you have the gods, and the gods are our overseers. They watch over us. They protect us. They guide us, and they protect us from negative forces, right? And then they have the Jotnar, who are those negative forces. Now, the words that represent this are Bjarg and Njuv, right? And I'm sure Njuv is like Nalvis, the rune, need. Now, it's not really need, like you think of in the modern sense. It's like calamity, distress, things that are bad that happen to you are needs, right? And the Bjarg are the helps, they're the things that benefit you, you know, the blessings of the gods. That's why in Havamal, Odin's first rune charm is called Hjelp. It's he's here to help you. Okay. In just about all of the prayers that we have left over to us, there's the mention of this word Bjarg or Hjelp, right? And these words show us that that's what the gods are there to do. Now, one of the things that I did in writing this latest book, The Ivan Runer, was I went through all of the runestone inscriptions. And I'm telling you, that was a really tedious and boring task because there's like 10,000 of them. And most of them are just like, you know, John made this for Joe, or I put this for my mom. She died of this. I mean, it's like all of them, but we did find some gems in there. And one of there were three different runestones that we found that mentioned something called the nine needs, right? And it's basically, they were like, some of them were curses, like saying, I throw the nine needs at you and all this stuff. And we really examined that. Like, what does that mean, the nine needs? And what we looked at and examined it, there's a passage in Fjolsvensmal where it says that you can bloat to the Deesir. And it's referring to goddesses, not the tutelary spirits. It's referring to the Freya and her retinue, right? And it says that you bloat to them, to the Deesir, and they will give you Bjarg that will counteract the need, right? So they'll give you their blessings to counteract the needs, all right? That's why we bloat. That's the whole basis of it. It's the concept that you have these calamities that the Jotnar bring, the giants bring, and then we perform bloat in order to keep that at bay. Bad luck, war, famine, you know, poverty, all of these different things that can happen to us. And that's why when you look in the sagas and you see like there are bloats, almost every time it says this bloat is for something, right? Like Frey's bloat is for Ar Okfrid, or good harvest and peace. Thor bloat is for the growth. Sigur bloat is for victory. You know, these are things that are counteracting, you know, something that is bad for you. You know, the opposite of victory is loss, you know, defeat. The opposite of good harvest is famine and starvation. You know, so you'd have like these nine needs that were needs the public community needed to in order to maintain benefits. Because you think about it philosophically, you think that, you know, if you really sort of look at the needs of an entire community, you could probably list like thousands of them, you know, and it would just become too confusing. And you have in Havamal where it says Odin tells us not to bloat too much, you know. And so it's broken down in the idea that, like, if you looked at everybody's needs and tried to make a bloat for each one of those, you'd be bloating forever, you know. So it just breaks down into nine general concepts of things that hurt a community, that will destroy a community. And then you bloat to the gods in order to protect you from them, right? And then you would have private bloat that would happen in the home, right? And that would be called a husbloat. And we kind of reconstructed that from a Norwegian term called bloathus, which was a private sanctuary, right? The bloat house is what it was. It was like a smaller form of a hof. And so we just reversed it and said husbloat is the private ceremony, the private bloat that will be performed in the bloathus, right? And so the idea of this is that, you know, you have your needs of your family, the things that are important for your family. So you perform those private bloats and private ceremonies for that aspect. Right. And so that's what this is. That's why you bloat. You're trying to protect yourself from bad luck, from bad things happening to you. You're trying to protect your community. You're trying to protect those around you. And when you look at it that way, it has a lot more significance.
That's really fascinating. But at the risk of me taking a very kind of scientific approach to this, you're still saying there that the reason we bloat is because the gods want us to bloat. Right. So you still need to have a faith that the gods exist and that we know what they want in order to know that bloat is important, right? And for those listening who aren't familiar with these terms, bloat is technically is an animal or human sacrifice, right? And then we tend to use the word feigning for those forms of offerings that we give to the god that don't involve the sacrifice of an animal or human. I'm still on an individual level, and I'm being completely frank here. I'm still trying to understand why the gods would want us to slaughter an animal or a human for them. And I mean, I do understand that if we're going to eat the animal anyway, then it should be done in a way which honors the gods. That makes sense to me. The idea that, you know, and I was rereading a book called Theodish Galifas by Swain Wodening, and he mentions in that book, he says, the reason we bloat, the reason we sacrifice is because the greatest gift we can give the gods is a life. And I thought to myself, you know, and I really like most of Swain's works, and I get a lot from his books, but I thought to myself, well, that kind of isn't true, because you're not giving the gods a life, you're giving them a death. Unless we kind of taking this view, and, you know, maybe I'm overthinking this, but unless you're taking this view that a death in this realm is a new life in the realm of the gods, but then you have this, you're bringing this kind of transcendental aspect into it, where the gods aren't part of this realm, they're part of another realm, and there's kind of this this kind of inverse transfer. When we kill something in this realm, it becomes a life that's a gift to them in another realm, kind of thing. So I don't know if you have anything to say on that. Feel free to just skip over that one if you want to.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about that, because that's an important topic. Yeah. So the most important thing that I would tell people is that there is a concept of bloat, right? That sort of, I believe, is a misnomer, right? And that is that there were academics that tried to connect the word bloat to the word bloda, or blothi, right? Which is blood, you know, because there are descriptions of human sacrifices and animal sacrifices, right? But there's later etymology develops and shows that that's not what that word means, okay? And that there is no relationship between the two. That the word bloat simply means to offer, right? And that's what it is. It's an offering, right? And so when we see accounts where, yeah, there's meat involved and there's slaughter involved. I've talked to people about slaughter, right? And there's a word called, I think it's slaughterfarn. And slaughterfarn is like, it's like a ritual slaughter that takes place. And it's like, well, if the word bloat just means, you know, slaughter an animal, then why is there a separate word for it, right? And if you look at some of the cultures and stuff like that developed, the slaughter took place separately from the blow. Because you got to think of like what a slaughter looks like. How does that develop? You're performing a ritual. You've got thousands of people in front of you, right? You have to take an animal and you have to kill it. And then we see the animal already processed in the ceremonies, like the blood's in the bowl and they've got, you know, the head on the stake and the skin is flayed. It's like that takes hours and hours and hours to do, right? Some of them had sacred stews. We talk a lot about the sacred stew that was created. They have sacred kettles and stuff like that. This, you're just creating a timeline anomaly that cannot be, right? So that I don't think that bloat involved ritual slaughter at all. You know, that these things, if they took place, they took place before at a different time in a different place. And then the offering took place during the actual ceremony.
Yeah.
But then you see like an Ibn Fadlan's account, you know, it's a very, very descriptive form of bloat seen there. Right. And they talk about all kinds of stuff, breads brought and vegetables and meats and beer and ale and all this stuff. Right. And those offerings are all considered a sacrifice to the gods, you know. The guy there is he's performing a bloat for prosperity. He owns slaves, you know, and he has a slave trade, and he's asking his god to watch over his slave trade and give him prosperity. And so he brings meats and vegetables and breads and foods and all that stuff. And that is bloat, you know. So I don't see bloat being an animal sacrifice or a human sacrifice. I understand that people did that at one time, right? And that there's definitely something to be said. And there are times when animal sacrifice is involved, right? But that's not what a bloat is, because the word bloat and connecting it to killing something is that etymological connection, which has really been discredited.
That's very interesting. So if I'm right, what you're suggesting is that it wasn't the snuffing out of a life before the gods, which was what the gods required. It was more that the product of the killing of an animal, the meat, the things that the community eats, you know, along with other foods, right, and wines and meads and things like that, because those things, right, are important to us for our sustenance, giving them to the gods is an act of generosity on our part. It's an act of submission, really. It's saying, you know, we are going to forego these things which are important to our sustenance because we are honoring you with them. So it's not so much that the gods needed to witness this act of slaughter. It's more that it's just so happens that, you know, most humans eat animals, and particularly in that era, in like the Dark Age era, I guess the Iron Age era, the early Anglo-Saxons and Germanics and Norse, meat was obviously a staple of the diet. And because it was important to us, it's therefore a worthy sacrifice for the gods to leave it for them, right?
Right. And that's the thing. It's like you didn't have slaughterhouses back then when we could snub our nose at those people. But, you know, you killed animals on farms. And most of the times when we see sacrifice happening, there was a tax on the farmers. You know, you see that in Ynglinga saga and other sagas where they would have the hof would be built, and then there would be a tax that would be placed on the farmers, and the farmers would have to allot so many of their cattle to the temple to be slaughtered and as form of sacrifice, which would be part of a communal feast. These animals are going to get slaughtered anyway. That's what they're there for. These are farm animals, you know. And so but the idea is that they're offered to the gods, you know. And so even with human sacrifice, we see it in many sagas and many sources that this was a form of capital punishment, right? People who try to knock our ancestors for that say, oh, well, they performed human sacrifice. Well, no, that they performed capital punishment, which we still do today, you know? And there was the Domringer, the judgment ring. People would be brought forth, and there's a saga that states that they would be brought before the judgment ring in order to be convicted to sacrifice.
Yeah,
so they would be tried for a crime.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people forget is that in a truly pagan society, everything is religious, right? Every single aspect of society, the law, art, language, marriage, even business transactions, as you say, capital punishment, everything is seen in the context of a religion. It's not like the secular society we have these days where it's kind of like everything is material and scientific and very cold and calculated, but you can once a week go to a church and you know exercise your freedom to to believe in something. Everything right. was done in the context of a religion. And as you say, even capital punishment was done
right.
as a religious act, essentially.
And I kind of put that onto the hands of Protestantism. You know, we all have differences with the Catholic Church and all that stuff. But the one thing that the Catholics have always had is a sense of cultural tradition and trying to overlay itself within that cultural tradition. And Protestants said, no, we're just going to be the Bible and we're going to try to strip the culture of its traditions. We're going to do it backwards rather than try to overlay it. We're going to destroy it, you know. And like that's why a lot of modernism is built around earlier Protestant concepts. Like when you see like modern architecture and stuff where it's just simple, basic, just boxes and things like that, that's what the Protestants wanted for their churches, because they only want the worship of Christ in their churches. And so when they saw like Catholic cathedrals and beautiful buildings and stained glass and all that stuff, they saw that it's idolatry and they want to destroy it, you know? And it's like that culture is what makes us who we are. It's a glue that connects us. And that's why we need it, and we need to bring it back.
Yeah. So we're kind of a little bit short on time for this conversation. We've got a couple more points I wanted to get to, so I don't know if we can get through them sort of fairly briefly. One of them is you talk about Sedianism. This is a concept which you're kind of known for promoting. And if you could just kind of define that for us very, very briefly.
Yeah. So like, I consider myself Sedian, and most of the people in the society do. Sedian is a concept because, like I said, when we first introduced a lot of this work, we had some pushback from people. You know, they weren't happy with what we were doing because they felt like we were, you know, kind of invading their territory with all this foreign things to them. You know, they'd been taught that you don't kneel before the gods. They'd been taught that, you know, that all these different lore from Snorri Sturluson and all these different things that they'd been raised up with and they just thought was correct. And then we came along and challenged a lot of that stuff. But a lot of the people that we did it, some of the more, you know, vicious people that we kind of encountered, it's like they didn't want anything traditional. They just want it to be new age. They just want it to be like creative and whatever I want it to be. And it's going to be this. And I've got this excuse for this and this excuse for that. And we finally reached a point where we're like, look, I don't really call myself Ausertru or Odinist or anything like that anymore. Because my problem with that is that those terms are too broadly defined. You know, they're just like these just overreaching, like whatever you feel like Odinism is or Ausertru or these different words, it's just what it is, right? And so we created Sedianism, which comes from Forn Sed, right? And Forn Sed means the ancient customs, right? Yeah. And so we just said, well, it's not ancient anymore because we're practicing them. It's the customs, you know, it's Sed. It is the customs that we follow. So we are Sedian, right?
So that's pretty much cognate with Theodish, you know, the belief of the folk and right. the fuse, the customs, you know, as is known in the Anglo-Saxon language. So I expect, I'm not an expert on the language, but I expect that Thew and Theod are etymologically related. And they both mean the same thing. They mean the customs of the folk,
right.
the ways of yeah. the folk, yeah.
Right. And so what we did when we developed that is we created 18 tenets, and these are the 18 tenets that follows our faith, because we realized, you know, I had a conversation with Hindus, and I talked to a lot of Hindus, and they told me, they said, the one thing we see about your religion is you have all these people that are so adamant about their politics, right? Just weird modernist politics that they've always got to fight over. And this is the way. Yeah. But when it comes to their religion, they become all these wishy-washy liberals and everything is just whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And all sides, from the far left to the far right and everything in between, they're all in agreement with that. Oh, just whatever we want it to be. And he's like, they said, that's not how you do anything. You know? And like, so what we did was we wanted to demonstrate that you can have religious assertions and still be polytheist, right? And how polytheists do this is they don't do it like monotheists. We're not out to like create a Vatican or anything like that and tell people there's only one way or any of that stuff. But how polytheists did it is they formed schools of thought. Right. And so you see this in Greece, you see it in China, you see it in Japan, you see it in all these different polytheist religions that exist. They form schools of thought. And then the differences that they have, a new school of thought pops out of it. And then another one. Right. And it's they have differences, but they do have a basic premise behind everything that they do. And then that just the differences becomes the new school. And so it's not just some ludicrous, like do whatever you want to thing. It's the idea that you have something. You know, and that was the problem with heathen. We kept noticing is that, you know, the people who were arguing against us and didn't like what we're doing had nothing in return. There was it's like, okay, well, what do you believe? What do you have? Well, I have, you know, this third grade mythology book that I read, you know, and I have like these smatterings of stuff on runes and things like that, but I don't really have anything, you know, and you'd ask them to prove their points and argue what they're saying and they can't do it. And it's not to, you know, to knock people. We're here to educate. We're here to help people. We're here to make this, make it better for all of us so that when you do face somebody who is nefarious or is trying to harm you, people who are trying to build cults of personality, people who are trying to grift you and things like that, you can have a basis and that litmus, that true north that says, no, we're not doing it like that. Okay. That's not the way it is. This is my religious assertion. This is what I believe. And we're not going in all these crazy directions. Right. So we created the 18 Sedian tenets. And it gives you a groundwork to define something. You know, this is what we believe. And there is no breaking away from that. No, like pretending I'm something else and all that stuff, because we have to have a solid foundation for our beliefs or it just becomes a big joke, you know, and that's what it has become for a lot of people. It's just a big joke. It's just like, you know, whoever's popular at the moment, that's the person who gets to be the leader. That's the person who gets to say what it is, you know. So with this, we say that the sources, that the tradition is the source of it, right? What we build from the tradition is fine, you know, but that you have to have some rock solid foundation that you can go back to and say, well, does this hurt this? Does it stray from it? Does it harm it? If it does, then we should examine it and probably do away with it, you know? So, and that's how you do that.
So it kind of, it's almost the antithesis, or it kind of keeps UPG, you know, unverified personal gnosis in check. And this is, you know, this is something that I've been kind of wrestling with on a personal level lately. I've been reading Colin Cleary's book or collection of essays, Summoning the Gods, and the kind of premise of his work so far from what I've read is the idea that we should actually expect to have some kind of, I don't know, some kind of two-way communication with the gods. We need to, in order to believe in them and accept them for what they are, we need to adjust our way of viewing the world to kind of accept the gods for what they are. And what I see in a lot of modern heathenry is this kind of very empty, cold, calculated, you know, you take a piece of paper, everyone stands in a circle and recites certain lines, you know, then we go away, maybe have a social discussion, whatever, you know, you're kind of going through the motions. But very few modern heathens tend to expect any feedback from the gods. And I wondered what your position is on this, you know, as someone who is so dedicated to reconstructing the tradition. And, you know, I said in a post on my Telegram channel recently that the way I see it is that the tradition is important because we know that that is how our ancestors got close to the gods, how they came to understand and perhaps even in some form communicate with the gods. So by reconstructing the tradition, we can put ourselves in the same, give ourselves the same advantage that they had won for themselves over, you know, perhaps centuries of trial and error. So what are your thoughts on this? As someone who is so dedicated to reconstructing the tradition, do you think that we should also be looking for ways of knowing that we're actually reaching the gods, some kind of feedback or some reward, tangible or intangible, from the gods? You know, what's your view on things like meditative work or even the use of psychedelics?
Well, the thing is about that is that the tradition is part of that, right? The tradition is, it's not that there's a separation between the two. Mm. You know, when you see a Hindu like reciting sacred scripture, that is his connection. Like he's connecting to the gods through that. And I understand like there's a place for personal prayer and meditation and different things that create that bond with the divine, right? That's absolutely a part of this. And no one's saying different. We actually did some research into the Undvigasulur, which is a sacred pole, in the shape of Thor, right? That's not sanctified as a god pole, but it's actually sanctified as a prayer pole. And they would drive nails into it called Reginaglar, which are god nails, right? And those would be like prayers. And so they would drive it into the pole, and that would, like when you go to a Catholic church and they light a candle to pray to somebody who's dead or something like that, it's the same concept.
Yeah.
Somebody goes in, they drive a nail in, they have a prayer for that. That's a connection to a tradition and a real connection to the gods. right?
Oh, yeah. Great example, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah. The tradition is always there. It's always a part of it. It pervades the entire concept of it. It's not to negate a personal relationship with the gods, because that is their personal relationship with the gods, right? And so, and it's also to say, not to say that you can't, you have to sit there and be rigid and, you know, make sure you do this and do that. It's to say that the tradition is part of who we are. And the one thing that we've, you know, sort of included into our bloat formula, because like I said, we got this new book coming out, the Ivanruner book two is coming out. And the one thing you're asking for the answer, right? Like you perform sacrifice, you offer to the gods, you sanctify the area, you perform the blessing, you sprinkle the mead or the blood. Some people think that sprinkling mead might be, you know, denigrating it, but we actually see that in the Vedas. They have what's called the Madhukasa sprinkling, and they use mead, soma madhu, right? I don't want to get off of that, but the thing is that relationship and that personal bond that you're forming comes through divination. And a lot of people didn't see that. They see divination as some sort of like hocus pocus, whatever, right? And I'll explain divination. It's very crucial. Divination is not a concept where like people with superpowers can tell the future, okay? What it is that divination is very much part of a fatalist belief system. And any system that has a fatalist viewpoint is going to have divination. You know, you look in Japan and stuff like that. These guys, they have all kinds of ways to tell the future. Those things are not hocus pocus. They're very much the idea that if you believe that all of existence is a part of this interwoven web and it's all connected, then you can peer into that web by using the concept of destination or destiny to read into it. So you take some objects that have prescribed symbols onto them, and you throw them onto a cloth, right? When you throw them onto the cloth, those things are destined to land a certain way. So that is destination. It's destiny. It's fate. It's going to be fated to land a certain way, and all you got to do is know how to read them.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Literally just know how to read it. And so when you know how to read it, then you can see in what's going to happen. But the main thing is with divination, a lot of people think that it was all just about, you know, fortune telling and seeing the future. Most of the references that we have are trying to see if the gods accepted our sacrifices.
Yeah.
In almost every single instance, almost all of them. And we put that in the first book. We show all of these different instances. They're performing sacrifice and they're trying to see if the gods accepted it and answered their prayers.
Yeah. You know? I'm really glad you brought that up. Divination is one of the examples that I came up with of feedback that we can receive from the gods. You know, another is things like meditation. Another is seeing signs, you know, like seeing two ravens shortly after you've performed bloat or something like that. Or even
that's a divine... test in an Inglega saga.
Yeah.
Seeing the signs.
Yeah. Or divine encounters like some of us have had. You know, I believe that I was visited by Woden in the material realm in Midgard, things like this. So there are ways that we can look for feedback. And what I've started to do is to work that into my practice. So I'll perform a feigning or, you know, as people might commonly call it, a bloat. And I just did one the other day for Eostre. And I personally believe that Eostre is Freya. The Dawn Goddess, and you know, Mark may disagree with me there, and maybe I'll come to change my view on that in the future, but I believe that they're the same. I performed this feigning.
I can debate you on it.
Sorry?
Huh? I can debate you on it.
Yeah.
Do you
know what? I would love to hear your views on that, but we're kind of short on time, so maybe we'll have to do
it. We can go over a little bit. I got a little bit of time if you want to go over some.
Okay, well, let me just tell this anecdote, and then you can, as briefly as you can, tell me why I'm wrong that Eostre is Freya. You know, my daughter and I performed this this feigning, and then we to Eostre. And then we cast some runes afterwards, and I was introducing my daughter. She's 9 years old. I was introducing her to the concept of divination or reading the runes. And I was telling her that she can ask certain questions. She can address the goddess. She can ask her certain questions. And one of the questions she asked, in fact, I believe it was the first question she asked, was, Eostre, who is my goddess? And the rune that she pulled out was the Beoch rune, the birch rune, right? Which is the rune which is sacred to, I believe it's Frigga, but also I believe Freya as well. So yeah. She had an answer there, a very direct answer. And as you say, this is a form of feedback that we can get from the gods and goddesses. And I personally believe that when we perform a feigning or a blot, we are sending some form of communication to them. And then we need to be on the lookout after that for, and I don't know if this is attested in the law, but after that, we need to be on the lookout for signs in return from them.
Absolutely. You see that in Germania. You know, they have a sacred white horse that they would keep at the temple. And they would look at, like, you know, study its neighs and all that stuff to see signs from the gods. And they looked at the language of birds. I mean, looking for signs is part of it.
Yeah.
Because you believe in a fatalist system. When you believe in fatalism, you believe that nothing is coincidence, right? And that's why I say it's not hocus pocus. It's literally like you don't believe anything's coincidence. Everything happens for a reason. So when something happens, you're like, what's the reason? And you try to figure it out.
Yeah.
And that tells you, you know, if I'm sitting there performing a bloat, like I literally had one time we performed a bloat and a deer just walked right up on us, like in a place that we didn't even know deer was. And it just like came into the bloat area. We were like, oh man, look at this, you know? And we get all kinds of signs and stuff like that. And yeah. And there's just, there's all throughout the sources, you see signs. And, you know, I think there was, like you said, Ynglinga saga, and there's just, what's the other one? The Chronicon and different sources, different historical sources show that they were looking for signs all the time because they were fatalists. They believed in fate. They had three Norns that wove the web of destiny, and they were looking into that web.
You know? When you perform bloat enough for enough years, it won't be long before you'll come across some kind of very strange or unexpected experience like the one Mark just described with a deer walking into the circle. And my conversation with Stephen McNallan, he talked about visitations from a bear during these things. And I've had instances where immediately after we performed a bloat, a thunderstorm broke out all around us. And, you know, things like this, these things definitely do happen when you've been practicing for a little while.
Right. I took my brother. I just had a bloat and I wanted to do it. And I took him, we went on top of a mountain, and I was, this was when I first started performing bloat. I was like a kid and I didn't really know a lot about what I was doing, but it was probably one of the most powerful ones I ever did. Cause I'm standing on the side of this cliff. And I have a huge fire roaring and I'm, you know, libating the mead and all that stuff. And the wind starts kicking up and the lightning starts striking. And my brother was like, that was the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It just blew me, like, because it just started like really like going and stuff. And it just added like this almost cinematic feel to it, you know? And I was like, yeah, that was pretty neat.
and you need that magic, because that magic is what lets you know that you're on the right path. It lets you know that there is an incredible meaning to what you're doing.
Right. And the thing is that, you know, there's an aspect of the gods joining us. I try to look at things from a theological perspective of how things manifest throughout the faith, right? So, like in particular, we have sources that tell us that when the men would stand on the battlefield and they would start singing the shield song, right, that they would know that Odin was going to give them victory when they could feel his voice join them, right? Mm. And in Havamal, it says that, you know, when he wants to give victory, he sings under the shields. Okay. This is a form of Galdr, right? And we have a whole thing on Galdr, right? And this form of Galdr that happens, it's when the gods join you for anything, that's when they're there to bless you. You know, when you feel that presence, that reverberation in the Galdr, that becomes the gods' voices telling you it's going to be okay. We're here. We're going to help, you know?
Wonderful.
And that's what I believe very strongly, you know.
Okay. Well, if you've got time, we've got one last topic to go through. I don't know if we can do it justice in a short period of time, but let me know what you think, Mark. And this is the idea, and this was your suggestion of reconstructing ritual and the sacred space and the significance of this. So, what have you got to say about that? Because, you know, this is something that I've heard a few people talk about, this idea of ritual connecting us back to that first act of creation, sacrifice connecting us to that first act of, you know, creating the material realm out of Ymir's body. So, you know, what is the importance of this, the sacred space and ritual?
Well, I think that in looking at a sort of a world comparison, you see that one element that polytheist religions have, and even some monotheist religions have, is that when you're trying to develop a sacred space, you're trying to immerse yourself within sort of a divine realm, right? Like when the Hindus perform their ceremonies, they see the altar as like the center, like the home of the gods is what they call it, right? Because that's what it becomes. It becomes like the home of the gods. The gods are brought in and to come stay with us for a minute and visit with us as friends, right? And that's why I say bloat is about offering, because that's what it is. You don't have any source anywhere that says that bloat is, you know, that the gods crave blood. You know, there's nothing like that. But it does say in Havamal that if you're going to be friends with somebody, give them gifts and they'll give you gifts in return, right? Yeah. And that's what it is. It's offering gifts and saying, this is my friend and this is somebody I want, who I love and I care about. And this is, I offer this to you in the same way you would treat a guest, which is a holy thing. Even the treatment of a human guest, a holy thing, right? Yes. And so when you're looking at the building of this sacred space, the sacred area, you're trying to reconstruct the cosmology. This is what all religions do. All of these religions, they're looking at cosmology. And when you didn't see that before, right? And that's how we really know when we're onto something, is when you can develop something and then it just kind of bursts open and all these different things come out of it, you know? And so like when we were looking at Snorri Sturluson's cosmology, it's just kind of all over the place and it's crazy and weird and you don't understand it. And like Rydberg said that basically he felt that, you know, Snorri Sturluson was doing what Christians did back then, and that was toppling pagan trees, right? That he turned the tree on its side. Because in Grindismal 31, it says that the roots of the tree are beneath the tree, just like a tree, right? Any tree that you see, the roots are below it. And that's it. The word is undan. Undan I ask Yggdrasil.
What a radical idea. What a radical right, idea that exactly. Roots would be beneath the tree.
Right. Well, this shows you the stubbornness of it. This passage clearly describes exactly how Yggdrasil looks and what it is. But then Snorri says, no, one root is in heaven, one is in Midgard, and one is in Niflhel, right? And it's like, so it creates like this up and down thing. And so many artists and scholars and all these people try to make all these weird justifications for it. I've seen it where the tree is like diagonal, you know, where it like goes up diagonal and there's the one here and one here and one here. And it's like, it doesn't make sense. It's like, if it doesn't make sense, then it's not real. It's just a mistake or it's purposely done that way, you know? And so the thing is that when you see that there is Asgard, which is in the branches of Yggdrasil, and then there's Midgard, which is the trunk of Yggdrasil, and then there's the underworld, which is the roots of Yggdrasil, then you really start to see the cosmology come into play. And all of these other realms that you hear about, which are called Heimr, which means homes, have been translated into worlds, right? The word Heimr does not mean world. There is the word world comes from Old Norse, Varaldr, which means the worlds, right? And so the word Heimr just means a home, which could be anything. It could be just somebody's house. It could be a nation. It could be a land, stuff like that. Most of the lands that we hear about, Alfheim, Vanaheim, Jotunheim, Niflheim, Helheim, Surtheim, all of these Heims are in the underworld, right? They're all part of that cosmology. And Rydberg breaks down how that looks and what it is. When you start to understand that, then a cosmology starts to unfold. And when it unfolds, then sacred space starts to unfold because you can literally see it. And you see the symbols in the objects that we have, you know, like the Ur horn, the sacred Aurochs horn. You know, the first world, the worlds that were created, Midgard and Asgard, come later. And Audhumla is there in the underworld, the first world, right? What's called in Hrafnagaldr's Odin, the word is Jormungrund, which means the great ground, right? And it's the same concept as the word Urmensul, which is the great pillar, right? And so the great ground, Jormungrund, the underworld, becomes the epicenter of all the activities of the gods. It's where the Helthing is located. It's where the realms of the damned are located. It's where Yggdrasil grows. It's where the three wells are and all this, right? And so when we see that the underworld is this, then the sacred space, the grounds that we're on, when we're standing in front of a holy tree, we're standing upon that part of the cosmology. And so the altar mimics that because that's where the activity, Asgard is where the gods go to rest. You see that in Valhalla, like they come down the Vigrid, which is in the underworld, and then they rest in Valhalla. And that's where they feast and all that stuff. But the work, the activity, the things where they create you know, the Hurg and Hoven, the altars and temples, right? All happens down there at Idavolur, at the underworld, right? And so when you see this cosmology develop, then you can create a sacred space. And one of the things that we discovered is that, and one of the people who pioneered this long before us was Nigel Pinnock, right? Yeah, he put a lot of books out, stuff like he had a book called Games of the Gods, and he went into a lot of this stuff as well. And it's the 9-square grid, right? Now, when we first started looking at this, you know, I'd seen some of the stuff on it before, and I was like, well, there's a little bit there. I don't really know that there's much. But then the University of Denmark and several other universities started coming out with more and more evidence on this. And so we did some research on it, and we found out, like, this is the sacred space. Like, this is it. When Osburg, grave was discovered, then they found the poles, those cats you see, those poles, somebody reconstructed and found out it was a sacred space that had these rattles on it, and it was in the form of a square. Right. When they've looked at old temple layouts, like old Hof layouts of heathen temples and stuff like that, they'd find poles that made up a 9-square grid if you put lines on them. Right. There are these pendants that they have discovered, hundreds of them, that have this 9-square grid on it. And it directly, they believe, directly relates to the Web of Weird, because they have Valkyries, they have horses that have that symbol on it, and they believe it connects to the Dráðurjarl, which is the web of battle, the poem about that web of battle that's being weaved, right? So the 9-square grid is mentioned in the sagas about, like, you know, when they were trying to connect to and communicate with the dead, they were trying to solve a murder, and they wrote the 9-square grid out, and the dead came into it and spoke to them and stuff like that. When they performed a Holmgang, they would draw a 9-square grid out or a square grid out, and they would fight in that. There's just so many references to it, right? And it's something that's firmly attested in the lore and becomes something that's sacred to us.
It makes sense as well. It makes sense as well, because a 9-square grid is the smallest grid that has a central square, right? Because the next smallest grid from a 9-square grid is a 4-square grid, and you've got no central square there. So you've got got that kind of that central kind of point of stability. So, yeah, and obviously it ties in, you know, I mean, most listeners will be familiar with the connection of the number 9 with Norse law, with Odin, with the 9 homes, as Mark would say, rather than the 9 worlds. So it's a sacred number. So it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so there are sources that say that the bloat would be performed in the center square, you know. And probably because that's where, you know, Gnungagap is, where the center of the underworld is Mimir's Well, is Gnungagap. The tree comes out of that and all that stuff. There's so much about the center, the central area, yeah. Right? And so once you've developed your sacred space and you've sort of broken it down and you see all the symbols and the lore and all that stuff, and we have that, then you start to look at, like, how do I perform bloat, right? And what elements of bloat are important and integral? Now, when I say this, like I said, I'm not trying to disparage what people have been doing, right? Because I know there are a lot of people do bloat in their own way, and they have their own methods to it, right? But what I try to explain to people is, it's like trying to teach somebody how to drive a car, okay? If I was trying to teach you how to drive a car, and I told you, look, you got to put your hand on the steering wheel, you know, 10 and 2, and you got to push the vertical for gas and the horizontal for brake, and then you want to, you know, put it in drive and all that stuff, this is how you drive a car. And then somebody else came and said, no, I think that the way you drive a car is by sitting backwards and, you know, throwing stuff at the people in the back. Like, that's not how you drive a car. You know? And so the elements, and when I say that because there are elements of bloat that make it bloat. You know, there has to be an offering. There has to be some sort of gift, right? Yeah. And there has to be some form of divination so that you know whether or not the gift was accepted, right? Yeah. It's just the mechanics of it. It's how it breaks down. And so you have to have a gift. You have to have a way of sending that gift through the elements. Like we see in the sources, you know, you have burial for earth, hanging for air, burning for fire, drowning for water, right? You have, you know, different structures that you build, like there's sacred gates that were built in the east that the offerings would be made to. And those gates are mentioned in so many sources, like all over the place, right? You'd have all kinds of different elements to the ritual that would take place in order for the ritual to be what it is, you know? And so another element that we've introduced and we've been teaching people is that bloat should be sung, right? And I know this is something a lot of people haven't been doing and all that stuff. I do know a lot of Theotis guys have been doing that. I've followed Theotis stuff forever. And I think that a lot of stuff you guys are doing is fantastic. You know, it's just incredible because there's so many pioneering things that have happened as far as following the sanctity of it and the worship of it and the devotion of it that people were doing back in the 80s and 90s, where other people were just like laughing at that and didn't really pay attention to it, you know?
I agree. I think they're being kind of validated more now than ever, actually, the Theodish guys.
Yeah. Absolutely. Especially with like monarchy and the appreciation of kings and queens like that. We're trying to push that and showing people that that's a thing, you know? And there's definitely a lot of aspects to this that we need to appreciate and value. Now, the one thing that I tell people is that when we're talking about singing a ceremony, the first thing you have to recognize, like I said, look at the world, okay? All the religions on planet Earth, except for Protestant Christianity, sing their ceremonies. Even Catholics, you know, Muslims with their minarets. I mean, you see all these people, everybody sings their ceremonies.
Very important.
Singing
point.
Is the way to reach the gods. You know, it tells us that Odin only speaks to us in verse. All the gods only speak to us in verse, you know. The reason why, like in Ynglinga Saga, it says that the gods came to us and they brought us Ljóðahattr and Gaudrálag, right? Now, and because of that, the gods are called Ljóðasmiðr and Gaudrasmiðr. These are the smiths of the Ljóða and smiths of the Galdr, right? This is very important. When Odin hangs on the tree, he learns nine Fimbuljóðr. This word ljóð, L-J-O-E-D-A-R, ljóðr, is the plural form. This word means sacred song, right? And when we look at this and we see that the gods themselves brought us these two meters, these two very important meters, that this becomes our way to express ourselves to them and worship them, right? And that, like, and this started in looking at Hinduism too, because Hinduism is the same way. They have very specific meter forms that are in the Vedas and different forms of scripture that are used, that are seen for different purposes, just like we have. We have like Drottkvitt, which is for storytelling and stuff like that. And then we have Ljóðahattr and Gaudrálag, which are for worship and prayer and singing, right? Now, one thing that we've shown people, and this is a big thing that a lot of people do, is that they think that singing rune names is a form of Galdr, right? And some people think that that's the only form of Galdr, when that isn't a form of Galdr at all. That's not Galdr, all right? This is something some people picked up and kind of rode with. And some people think that it's like from Kabbalah or something like that, where they take Hebrew names and they sing it, you know, sing just the word, the letter or whatever. But there's nothing in our sources that says sing rune names ever, you know? And what it is Galdr is singing Gaudrálag. It's the verse form of Galdr, and it comes from the gods. And they teach us to sing this Galdr. And we have some of it, like Groa Galdr, the Galdr of Groa. This is every one of her songs that she's singing, the Galdr she gives are all in verse forms. And we have a lot of Gaudrálag. There's like 60 different verses that we have that we can use in prayer. We're going to be putting that in this book as well. And so the singing of the Galdr in Blót is sacred. It's important. It needs to be done. The gods need to hear our voices. They need to hear us singing again. And so we put together the Blót structure from that, having nine segments of the Blót, nine songs, you know, just like Odin has nine Fimbuljóðr, right? And we see the Indo-European connections to that, to Soma and the prayer, the songs of the gods, and Mimir is connected to it, and the singing, the drinking of the sacred meads are, and then the layout of the altar is, because we put three bowls on our altars, and those bowls each represent the three underworld wells. And you drink from this and you gain inspiration, all these different things, you know, that it all comes together as some sort of, it's like a vast puzzle. And then we're all kind of just starting to see it slowly converge, and it's becoming a religion. And the more that we put into it, the more we see this, and we're not making up stuff. Sometimes we have to fill in the blanks. I mean, it's just the way it is, you know, but most of the times we can see it. And the only thing I tell people is like, hey, if you're going to use UPG, it's fine. Just let it build from the tradition rather than contradict it or negate it. Right. And so like, that's what we're trying to do. So like, we're trying to get as close as we can to this so that we can worship through the tradition, but also have that personal experience in everything that we're doing. And so ritual, if I can just go into one more thing, right, on this, because it's really important. we're talking about the questions, right? People ask me questions and stuff like that. And there was one, I mean, this was just great, man. This was like the coolest thing that we got to do. This guy comes to me and he asked me, he says, is there a heathen equivalent to what the Hindus call the pranayama murti, right? And if I messed that up, please forgive me. But it's a ritual that the Hindus have that brings their statues to life. It makes their statues something that's worthy of worship. Can you sanctify a statue in a way that manifests the divinity within it so that it becomes something that can be worshiped, right? And that's what I was saying before, like the Undvegasular is it's sanctified as a prayer pole, not as a god pole, right? The god pole or god statue, Skurthgod, carved god, right? And so I was like, okay, well, let's look at that. Let's look at instances in the lore where we see statues come to life, right? And the obvious one is Mimir's head, right? Where Odin takes his head and he makes it, sprinkles herbs over it and stuff like that, and it speaks to him. In Saxo Grammaticus, that head is actually changed into a statue, right? Now, the thing that was amazing, that was just so cool about this, is that we started looking at all the other sources, like Frithjof's saga and some of the other sagas that we have on this mention, like herbs are mentioned in it, leeks are mentioned in it, and linen is mentioned in it, right? Now, one of the significant sources that we found on this that's really been misunderstood is the Völsungaþáttr, right? Now, the Völsungaþáttr is a poem that was written. A lot of people think that this is a poem about a horse cult because it mentions a horse penis in it, right? So they're like, oh, it's a phallic cult. And that just kind of let people gloss over it. Oh, it's a phallic cult. So it's about penises, you know? And it's like, no, like you have to critique these things and look at what is being said. This isn't about a horse penis at all. There's nothing in there about that. The horse penis is there to make fun of it, right? It's literally a piece of Christian propaganda is what it is. But it's significant because it's a piece of Christian propaganda. Because what happens is you have this, you know, this lady, they sacrifice a horse, his penis is left over, the lady turns it into some sacred object, she starts worshiping it, which sounds silly, right? And then all the people in her farmhouse are all like disgusted by it. Like the kids are playing with it and making fun of it and all that stuff. And then when she makes them all come in the evening and pass it around and say a prayer over it. And people are just like, this thing is gross. I don't want to touch this. Why am I doing this? This is disgusting. And then Olaf Tryggvason comes in as the Christian king and tells them all, you know, he pretends to be a part of it. And then at the end of it, he tells them all, you know, you don't have to do this anymore. And they're like, yay, Olaf saved us. And then he rides off in the sunset, you know, obviously a piece of Christian propaganda, you know? And so like, but the thing is that we believe is because in this poem, we see references to things that we see in other sources regarding the sanctification of a statue, that's what they're doing. They're making fun of this, right? They're taking an actual ritual, an actual ceremony that was performed in the sanctification of a statue, and then they turn it into a silly object that they make fun of, right? And it also mentions the leeks and the linen and, you know, augmenting it and sanctify it. And one of the refrain in it is, talks about the morn. It says, may the morn accept our blighty, which is a word that means bloat as in sacrifice. But in this form, the word bloat can also mean a statue, right? So it's saying, may the morn accept our statue. Okay. Now the morn are giantesses, which is probably part of the propaganda thing as well. You know, that they're saying like they worship these demons and all this stuff, right? Whereas it would be a way of sanctifying a statue and bringing it to life using herbs and leeks and linen, smearing it on there. The word that we found consistent through several of these sources is smyria, which means to smear or anoint, right? Which is interesting because the word butter in Old Norse is also smyr, which is the same word, right? Because you would smear butter. And in Hinduism, we see that ghee is the primary means by which they sanctify their statues. So they're very much Indo-European connections. I mean, we just started finding all this stuff. And it's like, man, we know how to do this now. We know how to bring statues to life so that they're worthy of worship. And we actually, there was something that was really amazing that happened is the Urmin folk used this and they performed a bloat with it. And they used the smyria ceremony at their festival. And they sent me a picture of it. And their statue was the famous statue of Thor, the little statue that where he's like holding the beard, you know, and it forms the Thor's hammer and all that stuff, right? And in the flames, you see that statue, like in the smoke, And it's like, they were like, look at this. You have to see this, you know? And I was like, it's incredible, man. It's incredible to be finding these things and making these discoveries. And then then something spiritual like that happens from it, you know? Because like the sanctification of the statue is the start of the religion. It's like how you get started, you know?
So. Yeah, I'm kind of a bit mind blown, actually. I mean, earlier on in the conversation,
nor we.
yeah. I mean, a common thing that gets said in heathen or Arsatru circles or whatever is that there are gaps in our law, right? And I was going to, at the beginning of this conversation, I was going to kind of start off the conversation by asking you, are there gaps in our law? And it was kind of going to be a rhetorical question, because I know that for you there are not. And I think over the last, you know, we've been talking for over 2 hours now, and I think you have demonstrated quite clearly that there are no gaps. And if anyone can find a gap, that gap can be filled with a bit of due diligence, a bit of research, and in quite some detail, quite clearly. So I really have to commend you for the work you've done to do that. And I think we're at the end of the conversation now, and we've gone a little bit over, but I mean, man, we could talk for hours more. There's so much more that I could ask you. So I'd definitely like to extend an invitation for you to come back on to the Fergan podcast in the future.
Absolutely.
But before you go, could you just let listeners know about your books and your website and things? You know, I must admit, I'm a little bit hazy as to which of your books I should be approaching in what order, you know, which would be, you know, so if you could just speak a little bit about the books that you've written and published, where people can buy them.
Right. So we have a bunch that we've put out. You can go on our website, www.norrena.org. Right. All of our books are on Amazon as well. So we did The Nature of Ostru, which is a primer. We had the Ostru Edda and the Odinist Edda, which are the lore. You know,
what are the difference between those two, Mark? The Odinist Edda and the Ostru Edda?
Well, it's kind of funny, because like when we first put the Ostru Edda together, there were a lot of people who came to us and were like, I cannot stand the Old Norse characters in it. You know, the Edd and the Thorn and all that stuff, you know, it was driving people crazy. Right. So we're like, we'll just make an anglicized version. You know, we'll just take all those forms and do that, and we'll call it the Odinist Edda, you know?
Right. Okay.
And we plan on doing one later on, where we're going to try to, you know, update the research and all that stuff and try to get closer to the sources. Now that we have a lot more resources, we're going to call it Aldarunr, because we're trying to make like, the idea is that Heimdall came down and taught us these things in Ivanrunr and Aldarunr. And Ivanrunr are the runes of earthly life. That's the practice. That's the ritual. That's the orthopraxy. And Aldarunr are the runes of the ages, you know, like the Gullaldr and the Wulfaldr and all that stuff. Those are the ages. And so the Aldarunr are the runes of those ages. It's the lore. It's the telling of the lore, right? So we're going to be doing that later and trying to get it closer and actually trying to break it all down, right? We have the Otis book, which is our book of philosophy. We try to actually break down, like, we have tons of books that were Ostru 101, you know, Heathen 101 books, trying to give you just a basic primer. This is like a 202. This is advanced philosophy. And we're going to eventually, I got some guys who are real big into philosophy, much more than me, and they want to try to do a later version of that as well, right? We have the Aitr book, which is the book of clans. How to build a clan using a method that we've developed from the ancestral sources, plus things we just picked up along the way, you know, things that we feel like could help people. So that's not really like a research book. It's more just like a community building book, right? And then we have
very important in these times.
Right, exactly. And we have the Ivanrunr book two, book one, and the book two is coming out. There've been so many. We have the Ostru Edda study guide. We have the Sinda book, which we put out, but we're going to be, the Ivanrunr is going to negate that book, because this research is so big, you know? And so there's a lot of stuff. You can see all our books on our website and all that stuff, and all of them can be purchased on Amazon. The first Ivanrunr book, I actually had some issues with Amazon and haven't been able to get it overseas. I think it's on Kindle now, so people can read it on there, but, so we're just trying to figure out like how to get that done. So I think when I publish the second one, I'm going to go back and probably republish the first one, just so everything can come out all at once and everybody can get it all over the world.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, excellent. I'm definitely going to be diving into that material And yeah, thank you very much, Mark. I'm kind of a bit overwhelmed by the conversation because you're, as I said at the beginning, you're such a fountain of knowledge. And a lot of these things are, as you say, they're kind of, they're destroying myths, really, incorrect myths that we've been kind of adhering to wrongly, and they need re-examining. And it's right that there are people like yourself who are doing that. And it's definitely a way to push our ancestral faith forward. So, absolutely wonderful to talk to you, Mark. And any last words?
Well, I do want to say just in leaving that we talk a lot about, I just did a live video on this, where there are people out there who try to accuse us of telling people what to do and using sort of hoisting the Norna Society interpretation of things. And we don't interpret, we try not to interpret anything. You know, I tell people an interpretation is like, if you ask me what the Yggdrasil is, and I told you, well, it's like a symbol of the cosmos and all that's, and the connection of life and all this different stuff, right? That's my interpretation of Yggdrasil. But if you ask me, like, what does it say about Yggdrasil in the lore, then I'll give you an argument and show my evidence and build around that, right? Yeah. That's 99% of what we try to do. So we're never giving you an interpretation. We're giving you an argument. And if you want to show that we're wrong, come back with your own argument, right? And so that's what we're trying to do. And we're going to keep going. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time now. We have a lot of great people involved, Kyle Davis, Keith Osgood, you know, and a lot of the people who are helping us to build things. We're trying to build a community organization. You know, William Reeves is helping us, and all these different people are coming together to build this academic group that sort of changed the face of heathenry, because we're developing real arguments. We're developing things that just weren't there. It's not that we're trying to differentiate ourselves from everybody, but a lot of the stuff just wasn't there at all, you know? And it's like, if you want to come with something, then bring it. That's great. You know, we want to talk about things. We want to debate stuff. So we're really glad and happy to be on these podcasts. And, you know, we want to be doing more podcasts and spreading the word and showing people and talking to people and educating them. We're building a Gothi course, a Gothi program, you know, and we're going to be teaching people how to develop a real priesthood, a real priest class, you know, and there's just a lot of stuff coming. We're always building, always creating.
Wonderful. Yeah. And I hope that I can play a role in that someday. So
love to have you.
Thank you very much for all that you do and for speaking with me, Mark. And let's stay in touch.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I told you that one would be technical, and it certainly was. And I was happy to sit back and let Mark fly for the most part, because the wealth of knowledge that he brought to that conversation was quite profound, I would say. And that's an episode that I myself will probably be returning to a couple of times to just absorb all of the key points and find some new paths of exploration in that. And to finish this episode, we'll go to the Exeter Riddle Book to look at last episode's riddle, which was number 30. Actually, it was number 30A. And it turns out that was the first of two versions of that riddle, the other of which we've not yet come across. So this one seems to be a bit, there seems to be some confusion around this one. And the answer given in the book that I have suggests different answers depending on which lines we're looking at. So it talks about some of the lines speaking to a tree, some to ship, some to log, and then some to Christ's cross. One answer that it doesn't give, which I think reading it myself could have some credibility, is the answer of a flag. If we just read this one again, it's a very short one, so I'll just go through it again. See what you think. I'm surrounded by flames and sport with the wind. I'm clothed with finery and the storm's great friend. Ready to travel, but troubled by fire. A glade in full bloom and a burning flame. Friends often pass me from hand to hand. And I'm kissed by ladies and courteous men. But when I raise myself with reverence, proud men must bow to me. I bring man's happiness to full maturity. Now, I can see why, you know, it's thought that it could, you know, be quite Christian related, that one, but it seems to me that a flag, you know, the flag of one's king or kingdom, could also fit the bill on that one. So those are just my thoughts. And anyway, we'll move on to riddle number 31 for this episode. This world is adorned in diverse ways, decorated with rare ornaments. I saw a strange thing singing in a house. Nothing on earth looked in the least like this creature. Her shape was extraordinary. Her beak was pointed downwards, yet she cannot fly nor even move much. Though eager to start, she sets to work with her singular skills. Often and again, she goes the rounds at gatherings of men. She sits at the feast and awaits her turn. It comes soon, to prove her prowess in the halls of thanes. But there this creature never partakes of what makes warriors happy. Daring, anxious for fame, she stays dumb, and yet in her foot she has a fine voice, the glorious gift of song. I find it curious that this creature can extemporize with her dangling foot, richly decorated. When she holds her hoard, proud of her rings and naked, she bears her brothers on her neck, a mighty kinswoman. Even a canny poet will be hard put to name this creature. Yeah, that's an odd one. Yeah, I'll look forward to addressing the answers to that one in the next episode of the podcast. I'm not going to hazard a guess at that one now. Anyway, thank you all for listening, and it's always great to be speaking to you and also to receive feedback from you. So if you ever feel compelled to send me an email or leave a comment under the Odyssey video or something like that, please do. And you can find all of the information for that at fergen.com, F-Y-R-G-E-N.com. And you'll also find ways to support this podcast and some merchandise and things like that. So thank you all. And until next time, be well.